Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. You know, it's funny, I'm being so casual about this. I hope I don't forget something. No, seriously, it's this wild thing that's happening right now because I'm doing so many interviews. I had, I think two this week, three last week. It's like I'm always on microphone somewhere. You know, it's like I don't talk unless there's a microphone in front of me. It's the strangest feeling. I'm loving it. I mean, this is what I've been working for, what everybody else in Action Radio has been working for, is this incredible opportunity to get our citizen legislation and our legislature out there. And we've got, in fact, I just emailed one of my previous interviews earlier this week, Dave Krieger and the Power Hour, because we had this caller, Sherry, who called in from Kansas, and she had an idea. She says, I want to write a bill. Of course, Dave, the host, is like, yeah, that's great. Let's do that. He's making notes and all this kind of stuff. I just wrote his studio about half an hour before airtime. And Sherry was looking for a name for her bill. Well, she wants to stop people from being able to contribute to a campaign if they're not in the district, if they're not in the jurisdiction, if they're not in the state or the local or whatever it was. So, and she didn't have a name for it. So I thought we should call it the, No Contribution Without Representation Act, as opposed to the No Taxation. You know, taxation without representation is tyranny. And we could call it, contribution, No Contribution Without Representation, Act is also tyranny. So anyway, we're going to work on it. But I think No Contribution Without Representation is I think what we're going to call. I'm going to suggest it to them there. But that's how this works. And this is the most fascinating thing that's happened in the last 2 weeks, is that there have been such an incredible response to the interviews I've done. TNT, the Power Hour, we had Alpha Warrior, who's on Rumble. All these different shows that I'm doing, it's really quite fascinating. The response from every host is universal. They love the idea, which is probably why they have me on. So, I mean, I'm not going to have the hosts, call me up saying, I really think your idea sucks. I want to tear you apart. I'm like, actually, to tell you the truth, I'd love to do those interviews. Those would be fun. Those would be a challenge because those are the folks we need to let, the left thinks that there's nothing in this for the left, there really isn't, but for liberals, there is. For decent liberals, and I've mentioned this many times on the air, decent liberals are people who love the country like conservatives love the country, and me, our constitutional independents love the country. We just have a difference in how to go about fixing the problems. Their problems are bigger government, more money, things like that. Well, I can talk to liberals. I have no problem with liberals, especially if they can get the ACLU back on track and actually represent civil rights and not special individual pressure group rights. So if they can do that, that would be a huge change. But as far as liberals go, never had a problem with liberals. I was one in my youth, because I grew up in a liberal environment in New England, in liberal family. I didn't have a lot of choice because I didn't see anything else. So when this is the thing. When people are raised in liberal families, they never see anything else. It's easy to become liberal. But then you start getting out in the world and you pay taxes and you look around and, I did my internship in Washington and I got through a liberal college and, then I went to Europe. Okay, so most of my liberal education got tossed out in one day, and that was the day I crossed Checkpoint Charlie and went into a communist East Berlin. And not only – I didn't go to their little, Mozart plots or whatever they – or Karl Marx plots. Plots is plaza. So they have this little showpiece. It's like Disneyland. So you go through Checkpoint Charlie, and you get the communist version of Disneyland. And they had the rides, the amusements, and it was like a little party. And people – that's designed to make you think, oh, communism's not so bad. Well, of course, me, I walked right through that. That was like 5 minutes. And I'm going to the back streets and I'm going deep into East Berlin. I mean, deep, we're talking miles, because I was 22 years old and I could walk fast. So I went miles back in there and there's still bullet holes in the buildings from when the Russian soldiers came through and took over Berlin, And so it was fascinating. I mean, that's how poor they are under communism. There's still bullet holes. You can see them. They didn't fix them. The buildings were fine. They're still functioning. They're just, all these bullet holes. I mean, the combat was right there where I was walking. So it was quite impressive. And people are going about their normal day, bored. That's the thing. Communism bores you to death. It literally does bore you to death because there's nothing in East Berlin was one of the most depressing places I've ever seen. And that was for the normal people. You can imagine what the gulags are like, right? So there's no advertising. There's no color. Everybody's wearing, gray or brown, and the streetcars are all sort of a watery shade of beige. There's no billboards. There's nothing. There's no life. There's no storefronts because all the stores sell, the communist product. The labels are all the same. I mean, everything's the same. You know, I remember the restaurants, and I've told this story. Every table in a restaurant in East Berlin had a reserve sign on it because they didn't want you sitting there. They didn't want anybody going out to eat, you know, because they're paid by the state anyway. So why would you want to work? You can't accept tips. Nobody tipped in East Berlin, right? So there's no tips, no incentive, no profit, no nothing because it's communist. So why should they work? They're going to get paid anyway. So they put reserve signs on all the tables. I mean, there's communism for you in a nutshell. You know, and then people were somewhat healthy. I mean, they were, you know, they were just depressed and bored, and they just, you know, for like marking time. It's like, you know, you go through here and you go through and then you die, and that's it. No hope, no aspiration, no nothing. Which brings us to the Brandon insurrection. Okay, I might as well segue into this. I got about 25 minutes before Shirley gets here and we start talking guns. Jim's not with us. Jim takes off 1 week per month, and this is his week not to be here. So Shirley can have a little extra time. Maybe we'll start, maybe Derek will call in a bit early. I've got plenty of articles to talk about. And Amber Kemper's back. So Amber is back from the Patriot Academy, and this is in Texas. Amber is our high school graduate constitutional reporter. And I think I'm going to be branching that report out because she's got a lot of things that she can cover. So we're going to expand it. Like all reports, we expand it as far as the person wants to take it. And that's what makes it interesting. I mean, this show's about possibilities. Anyway, so back to Brandon. So the title of the show today, Brandon, that's zero intelligence. Inflation is still 8.5%. So if you measured intelligence in the Brandon administration, you get zero. First of all, because it's illegal. They're a bunch of criminals. They shouldn't be there. And everybody associated with it has no problem destroying your life because they're criminals anyway. You know, it's like the bank robber's bank and they take all the money. Do the bank robbers care what happens to the depositors? No, because they're criminals. In the same way, when the government steals the government from the people by voiding the election, do you think they care what happens to us? No, they stole the government. The whole thing about stealing the government, you couldn't care less what happens to the people. So while everybody's focusing on whether Brandon, you know, is going to run again, that's actually that's a distraction. The real question is, are the Democrats going to maintain the same policy next time with another Democrat? Of course, the answer is yes. So get your focus off Brandon. Brandon is a non-issue. You know, he's an old guy. He doesn't even know where he is. He's reading a script. He's playing at president, something he's always wanted. He thinks he's president, which is really kind of funny because he's obviously not. He should be on a, you know, on a porch watching sunsets and drinking lemonade and, you know, keep the kids away so it doesn't sniff their hair. So you keep the kids away from Joe. You put him on a balcony, you know, let him stay at one of his many vacation homes paid for by China, bribes and corruption and things like that. Plus what he took from his infants, you know, like Hunter, just stay there on the porch and drink lemonade and leave the rest of us alone, you know, find another figurehead. So the real question with the Brandon insurrection, it's the insurrection part. So don't worry about Brandon. The real question is, and of course, nobody asks this because they're asking the distraction question. Is Brandon going to run again? Who cares? He's not legal now. What do you mean run again? He didn't run the first time. He was a war. Well, he ran, but he certainly didn't win. So the question is, are the Democrats going to maintain the same policies next time? Of course, the answer is yes. Now, the most egregious one is this electric car tax credit. It should be immediately changed to a tax, you know, $25,000 hazmat fee on every electric car. You want to get back to gasoline cars? Simple. Put a $25,000 tax. And I'll recommend this to, the Trump administration and my Congressman Matt Gaetz, that you need to start putting a massive tax on electric cars, A, to pay for the subsidy, which never should have been given. So we got to recoup the subsidy by charging the electric car owners, and then put a further tax for the battery disposal fee. Well, I think $25,000 should cover it. All right, so here's what's going on in Washington. So they've redefined everything. They've redefined, you know, administration, which is a Marxist takeover of the government where they put a moron in the White House. That's the new definition of administration. Recession. The new definition of recession is the economy is great. There is no, you know, there is no recession. Everything's fine. That's the new definition of recession. Definition of inflation is 0%, even though it's 8.5, down from 9.1. So there's a slight reduction in inflation from last month. It didn't grow. So what they're really saying, there's 0% growth in inflation this month. Last month, it was July. That's what they're saying. And this is how they speak in Washington. It's Orwellian. You know, they need the Orwell department, you know, to go to get the correct language. So the actual increase in inflation, well, it's a slight decrease, but it's still at 8.5%. So instead of being horribly bad at 9.5, it's only 9.1. It's only slightly less at 8.5. So it's down 0.6. It's down a little over 0.5% from last month. Well, it's not down. It's still up 8.5% over last year. But that's how they talk in Washington. You know, it's like Rush Limbaugh was famous for talking about how they budget in Washington. You know, and the budget, they base last year's budget or next year's budget on last year's budget. So if a department gets, say, $100 million, so whatever it takes to run the Department of Orwell, of Orwellian language. So the Department of Orwellian language goes before Congress, and they say, well, we need more money. Well, how much did it get last year? Well, $100 million. Okay, so Congress starts at $100 million and then decides how much of an increase they're going to get. They assume a certain increase. I forgot what it was, 3%, 5%, 10%, whatever it is. They assume, of course, it has to be over inflation. So whatever the increases are going to be for next year, they have to be over, you know, 9.1% because that was the high inflation rate. So probably 10%. So they probably figure, let's put a little a fudge cushion factor in there. So all the budgets, all the items that come in under Brandon's budget for fiscal year 2023 are probably going to be at least 10% higher than this year simply to cover inflation. Because they can't have a budget cut, you know, unless they call it a budget cut, and they're not doing that. So figure that the Marxists are going to increase the budget at least 10% over this year simply to cover inflation. So that's how they do it. But they won't call that a raise. They'll just call that maintaining. So in other words, you know, you can't say, well, I'm just maintaining my budget, you know, by spending 10% more. Well, the bank will look at you and go, no, you actually don't have any money anymore. You know, that's real budgeting. But in Washington, they don't do real budgeting. And the biggest reason is because they don't have our bill, our constitutional amendment to stop Congress from borrowing money. Now you see how important that is. Not only would stopping Congress from borrowing money stop the national debt from increasing, and would actually lower the national debt and lower the interest on the national debt, it would actually stop inflation and pretty much end recessions. I mean, those are all caused by the printing of money. Well, the printing of money comes from the borrowing of money. So you stop the borrowing of money, you'll stop the printing of money, and you'll stop inflation, and you'll probably stop recession because our purchasing power is going to increase so much, people will get so much more for their dollar that they're going to happily spend it or invest it. If they invest it, they make more on the investment because the dollar is worth more. If they spend it, they get more for their dollar because the dollar is worth more. That's called deflation. It's the thing that we need more than anything else. And yet the Fed keeps saying, well, we've got to meet our target of 2% inflation. That's BS. That's 2% theft. So just think of inflation as theft, government theft. So how much theft is it this month? 8.5%. How much theft was there last month? 9.1%. Well, that's 91 cents. So imagine taking your bank account and the bank saying, okay, well, you know, you've got $1,000 in the bank. We're going to give you back 910. We're keeping the rest for inflation. Because that's pretty much what they've done. Right? That's how it works. So let's talk about Washington budgeting. So the Department of Orwellian Language comes in for their $100 million to rewrite the language and come up with new definitions for things. And they say, well, we need an increase. We need to get $110 million this year. Is that a $10 million increase? No. That's just maintaining the budget due to inflation. All right. So then someone comes in and says, well, we have to cut the budget 10%. Okay, well, we'll do that. So then the Department of Orwellian Language goes before Congress and says, we need $120 million. Well, why is that? Well, because we need $120 million for next year. Well, we can't give you $120 million. We have to maintain our budgets and we have to, you know, provide a cut. So we're going to cut your budget $10 million. We'll give you $110 million from your request. So what they do is they take the request of $120 million, cut $10 million off that, give them $110 million, which is what they wanted anyway, and call that a $10 million cut. Well, it's not a cut at all. It's not a cut from what you wanted to what you get. That's not what a cut is. A cut would be a low $100 million from last year. So what they really should get is $90 million. Which should probably be abolished anyway. But the point is that that's how they budget in Washington. And again, Rush Limbaugh was famous for explaining this, that a cut in Washington is how much they took from what you wanted. So if you want a 20% increase and they only gave you a 10% increase, they call that a 10% cut because it's 10% less than what you wanted. That's how they do budgeting in Washington. So this idea, so it makes perfect sense that they would say inflation is zero. You know, it's not zero overall. It's just zero between it's a zero increase between June and July because June was so horrendously high at 9.1%. I mean, that's incredible. That's almost 10%. 10% is what they call double digit inflation. Okay, so they're trying to avoid that at all costs. They don't want that double digit inflation label. So they put so much of our oil that Trump bought from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, you know, into the economy, into the world economy too. They lowered the price of oil, and so you know, through your taxes, are paying for Brandon's lower inflation rate in July by having, and Trump is paying for it because Trump bought the oil at a cheap price, you know, and they're selling it to make money for themselves, and the government that has stolen the government, you know, is basically artificially lowering the price of oil with our oil that we bought with our tax money, you know, and they're using that to their economic advantage. Well, they're crooks, so it makes perfect sense. They're stealing our oil. They stole the White House. They've stolen pretty much everything. They steal money from everywhere, from all of Americans. They're loading our country with illegals, going to China and, you know, sucking up to them and doing all this stuff. But that's how it works. So let me get you a couple articles here in the 15 minutes before she gets here and see if I can explain more of how this actually works. There's some pretty good articles out there. You know me, I don't take the obvious ones. We got to go for the good. So I found this new website called Election Central, and I'm going to contact them. I'll see if I can get them on the show because a bunch of really intense bloggers. And it says, why did Biden claim zero inflation when annual rate hit 8.5% in July? How does 8.5 turn into zero? And this is Nate Ashworth, and this was August 11th, so yesterday, in Election Central. That's the name of the website. He says, the short answer is that it's better to tout a short-term inflation index, which showed no inflationary growth in July, rather than the annual number, which remains close to double digits, there you go, there's that word, at a 40-year high. The, quote, zero inflation pulpit pounding is meant to break through to the low information crowd. That's what Rush Limbaugh often referred to, low information voters. In other words, people that can be easily swayed by propaganda because they don't know the facts. So the folks that listen to this show, you know the facts. So I need you guys to explain it to the low information voters, you know, your friends and family that think that, you know, COVID kills everybody, that the vaccines are safe and effective, and that Brandon actually won the election. You need to explain to those folks the truth, right? Anyway, the article says the zero inflation, and that's in quotes, pulpit pounding. Oh, I read that. I didn't read this. The zero inflation pulpit pounding is meant to break through to the low information crowd who will accept it as a data point and think that maybe things are being fixed somehow with Biden's new legislation, ironically called the Inflation Reduction Act. Well, of course, now the big joke is, well, if we don't have any inflation, why do you need an Inflation Reduction Act? Well, we do need that because it's green spending. You know, it's funny. They keep changing the name, you know, the Green New Deal, the Build Back Better, the Inflation Reduction Act. It's still bogus socialist spending. It's the same stuff. They just changed the title. They don't change the actual bill, which is why our bill for a mandatory 30-day comment period so that you can see what's in it would help not only us and the media. Media would actually have to report on it. We could actually see what's in the bills, and Congress themselves would actually, you know, have to read them. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, I don't have to, but at least the bill provides the opportunity. But 30-day comment period. So the Budget Reduction Act hyperinflation bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, which I call the hyperinflation bill, could not have been voted on for 30 days because you had to have the comment period, just like a regulation. So you want that bill, you have to make it go viral. You know, we need viral bills. We need our bills to go viral. If you want to see change, real change, and all you have to do is share the bill. Share the bill with media, share the bill with talk shows, share the bill with friends, share the bill with government, Congress, state legislatures, local government. That's it. Share the bill. Share the show. That's all you have to do. Millions of people need to do that and go viral. And then you want to see change? You will see change. Oh, yeah, real fast. Anyway, the new bill is not doing anything yet, back to the article, other than adding to the pile of government spending that got us into this mess in the first place. The fact that inflation cooled month over month means that demand is finally falling off because stuff is just too damn expensive and not much more than that. So why are prices dropping? Well, because nobody's buying anything. You know, we have record car repossessions, record defaults. I'm sure credit cards, there's record, you know, non-payment or cancellation or closed accounts or whatever they do. You know, there's all these things going on right now. There's defaults. I mean, you think people are paying the student loans? Well, I think some of them might have been, you know, quote, forgiven as if they committed a sin by borrowing. But all this stuff is going on right now. And it's really pretty incredible. But the economy is in sad shape. Then you look around and you see people, you know, they're going about their business. The people are still driving, although traffic is less. Have you noticed that? A lot less traffic out there right now. Why? Because people aren't taking trips unless they absolutely have to. They're combining the trips. They're using their, you know, once they fire up that gasoline engine, it's different. And of course, the electric car people have a problem too, because, you know, the Brandon insurrection, you know, well, that's not true. California and other states, the liberal states, are restricting the amount of electricity you can have for your car. So they force you into an electric car. They give you a subsidy to entice you to get into an electric car. You buy your electric car, and then they cut your power so you can't use your electric car. That's socialism. But what do you expect from a government that stole the government? You know, so this is how these things go. Let's get to Pianki here. Good morning, Pianki. What's on your mind with all this?
There's plenty to be on my mind, given all the things that is in disarray. That's easy. It's just like a flip of a coin. You can blind for like petting the tail on a donkey. When you take off the blindfold, you got it on his ear.
Yeah. Do you know people that are actually buying this nonsense that are going, oh yeah, inflation zero. Brandon said so. Everything's great. You know, while they're looking at the price of gas at anywhere from $3.50 to over $4 a gallon. Is anybody actually buying this? I mean, I don't think around here we're pretty conservative around the panhandle. But what do you think?
Yeah, you can stop them in the middle of a skateboard activity or a basketball game, and they would either question you, query you on what are you talking about, or you get that type of response. You got some on talk shows that's designed to attract a certain crowd that leans on victimization more so than anything else. And, of course, you got those that sell commercials. So, yes, there are some that look at it as John the Baptist.
How's that fit in?
Well, it just goes to show you the great job that began in government schools in creating the type of behavior and citizen that we have today that's uninformed and don't want to be informed.
Well, see, that's the problem. You know, that's what they talk about. Rush used to talk about low information voters. This is why democracy is so dangerous. And this is why, you know, people that push that everybody has to vote are it's crazy. I don't want everybody voting. I want people that know what's going on to vote. You know, you get a better vote that way. You know, same thing with this. You know, they take polls of people that have no idea the issue, and they use that to try and sway people that actually do know the issue, who then realize that they're in the minority only because the low information voters is such a large percentage of the population, but they don't have to be. Anyway, let me give you more of this article. I'm curious what you think of this. It says Biden claiming a monthly flatline on inflation while ignoring the 40-year high the country is still experiencing is par for the course for how this administration views the economy. We got a quote here from the insurrectionist himself. He says, yes, we drove up gasoline prices for the past 2 years, but please enjoy this 12-cent drop in the last 3 days. You're welcome. Well, how did he do that? And as I mentioned earlier, we know how he did it. He took our oil from our strategic petroleum reserve for emergencies, nuclear war, massive natural disasters, you know, whatever we need it for, sold it, artificially lowered the price so they could have better inflation numbers going into the election. That's what's going on here. Pianki?
Well, you made mention about low information voters. I think there's more out there than what you think, because just as you have just described, the information is there, but they don't know what to do with it and don't know how to compute it.
Yeah.
Quite natural, if you take oil that was bought decades ago at a lower price and sell it off at a minimal profit, well, those receiving it in all their honesty will reflect the cost that they paid for it and the cost that you're paying for fuel today, which is a little lower than what it was going into Biden's administration after 1 year.
Yeah, so, it's like my budget chat. You know, I was saying that if an agency gets $100 million 1 year, and they come back and they say, well, we need $120 million this year, and Congress says, well, we're only going to get $110 million, they look at that as a $10 million cut. Instead of what really is a $10 million increase. I mean, that's how they fudge things. That's how they think in Washington. This is the same thing. If the fact that inflation dropped 0.6% from June to July, because June was so incredibly high at 9.1, they said that there's zero inflation. I'm surprised they didn't say that there's a 0.6% drop in inflation, which would have been...
Well, you know, more importantly, Greg, is that National Strategic Reserve will run out. Then you're back online with the norm of the day, which is going to be $5, $6, $7, $8 gasoline prices because of the oil that you're purchasing.
Well, I almost hope we do run out so that it'll expose these people as the frauds they are, but I hope it doesn't run out because we might need it. So most people don't know where the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is. You know, I always had a vision of these tanks, massive tanks all over the place. Do you know where they put it? Do you know where the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is?
It's in the ground.
It's in the ground. It's in Salto. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's in these massive multi-million or billion gallon or multi-million barrel salt domes. It's actually a geological formation. And the problem is the way they get the oil out, how do they get it out? Well, they spray water in. Why? Because oil rises to the top of water. What do you think water does to salt? It dissolves it. So in getting the oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, you're weakening the salt. You're weakening the salt structure that held it in the first place. That's why it's for an emergency. That's why you only take it out under the most dire of circumstances. It's a very stable formation that you leave alone. But if you remove the oil, well, guess what happens? You destroy the container with which you held the oil because water dissolves salt. Now, they must know that because they're not completely stupid, but they don't care. And where's the environmental impact statement on removing all that oil from a salt dome? Ooh, there's a question.
You're absolutely right that brine mix that you create has the possibility of producing contamination into your water streams, your water tables.
Yeah. I'm going to see if I can get some attention on this. So environmental impact statement on removing, wish I could write faster, oil from a strategic S petroleum P reserve, the SPR. There we go. So yeah, let me get some more of this article. We got about 5 minutes before Shirley gets here. It says it's almost an insult to the American people who actually spend their money buying things like food and gas, something Joe Biden hasn't done in a couple of decades. The numbers on everything are still through the roof, and yet Biden goes to the microphone to proclaim mission accomplished, even though the inflation indicators are still on fire. The breakdown of individual categories can make your eyes glaze over, but here's a taste of what's happening under the hood that destroys the, quote, zero inflation narrative. And we got a little quote here from John Cooper. I guess this guy's at Heritage. He says, he's director of media and public relations. They say the Conservative Heritage Foundation. I tend to doubt that. I'll just call him the Heritage Foundation. He says Joe Biden claims multiple times it's a zero. Okay. The Bureau of Labor Statistics laid the data out in black and white, reporting the highest annual jump in food prices since the 1970s, with a 1.3% bump in at-home food costs from June to July and 10.9% food cost jump in the past year. So 1.3 food jump last month, even when the overall inflation rate, dropped slightly, but it's still an increase. It's a slight reduction in the increase. Then he says here, the all items less food and energy index rose 5.9% over the last 12 months. This is they call this core inflation. The energy index increased 32.9% for the 12 months ending in July, a smaller increase than the 41.6% increase for the period ending in June. The food index increased at 10.9% over the last year, the largest 12-month increase since the period ending May 1979. So everything's up. And like I say, the only reason it looks a little bit better is because they took our oil. They robbed our piggy bank. They robbed our emergency supply and put that oil on the market to make the overall numbers look a little bit better. But oil's still up. And here's the thing, too, that's weird. The people think that, well, look, the gas prices are down. They're not $4.50, they're $3.50. Isn't that great? No. when the standard is $1.85, $3.50 is what, twice as much? Almost twice as much. And yet the perception is, hey, look, prices aren't down. They're still up, by a factor of 100%. They're just down from 150%, from what they were. That's the difference. But it's all perception. Pianki?
I think he owned something.
Well, I have my moments. I try to actually relate the stories to the reports we're going to have. Derek's going to be on in an hour. And, of course, I'm going to talk to him about that, too. My question for you, next question, I'm going to talk to Shirley about this, too, when she gets here. The literal weaponizing of the IRS. Have you seen these descriptions about the IRS agents? One of the job qualifications is you have to be able to use deadly force. Well, against who? What, middle-income taxpayers? Who exactly is the enemy here? Why do they have thousands, 87,000 extra agents, thousands upon thousands upon thousands? They probably have at least 100,000 extra guns and a billion rounds of ammunition. I mean, that's enough to wage a war. I mean, the IRS could actually declare war, literally declare war on the American people, and they've got how many brigades? How many soldiers do a brigade or a division? Do you know?
A division is in the thousands, maybe 10,000, 20,000.
So these people have at least two divisions.
Maybe more.
Do you know how many divisions we had in World War II? 20. We had 20 divisions in World War II. All right. The Soviets had 120 divisions in World War II. Let's ask, how many soldiers in the division? How many? I would know that as Jim. I wish he was on this week. So, but Derek would know too. He's military.
So why would the states allow that? Why would the states allow a harder IRS agent coming to their state, working the state arm like that?
Well, I think the states don't know the power they have. I think that's one of the biggest problems. Oh, here we go. A division is a large military unit or formation usually consisting of between 6,000 and 25,000 soldiers. So the IRS is literally taking on over three divisions, and let's call them soldiers. Let's call them IRS soldiers because that's what they are. They're armed, you know, for deadly force. That means they're ready for combat. So we now have over three divisions. By definition, and this is, I'm taking the top number, not the small number. If we go by the 6,000 number, it's probably like 12 divisions. But they've got over three, no, six divisions. But they've got, no, six, six, or three, six. No, I was right the first time. Anyway, my math sucks. 25,000 soldiers. You know, that'd be 75,000 would be three divisions. They've got 87,000. They have 3.5 divisions using the top number of new IRS soldiers who are now in the IRS. That's an army. That's enough to create a war. That's a private army. And that doesn't count the other 200,000 bureaucrats that are armed that are already there. Shirley's like, oh, boy, what did I walk into this morning? Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Let me play your theme. I'll get a chance to think about that. You can tell me what you think of the new IRS army that has been thrust upon us. When one is faced with a crisis, you find your true character. How you react to such an emergency can determine the rest of your life. Two paths present themselves for you to choose. One leads to tragedy. The other leads to becoming a new person. Shirley Wattrall, a survivor of a dangerously abusive relationship, is that new person. She is the author of Heels to Holster. She is a firearms instructor, motivational speaker, women's empowerment advocate, and a reporter for Action Radio. So now, here is the DC Project, Women and Guns, with Shirley Wattrall. Hey, I saw your Facebook page. You've got your own firearms page now. Is that new?
No, it's been there.
Well, you should have told me.
It's been there for
a
while.
You're supposed to plug these things so that we know, Shirley. This is why you're on the radio, Shirley. Tell us what you do.
I'm trying to still figure that out.
Oh, okay. Well, you can figure it out here in front of millions of people.
I never thought about that. Yeah, I could do that.
That's what we're here for. So what do you think of the IRS KGB Gestapo? Yes, I said it.
I think it's very,
as Mark Levin would say.
It's very disturbing, actually. Yeah. You just think about it. When you saw, I read somewhere, it was on Facebook, their requirements. And like you said, they're supposed to be able to use deadly force and they're supposed to be carrying. I'm like, huh, what the heck? I thought these were number crunchers.
Yeah, they're accountants. Yeah. So
apparently, apparently they're just, that's what they used to be. And now they're turning into, like you said, a little, I don't know what they're turning into.
Well, no, it's a private security force. It's an IRS Gestapo. It's an IRS KGB because they have access to incredible information. Now, it's one thing, there are a bunch of bean counters, you know, wearing pocket protectors and thick glasses like Buddy Holly. I mean, those guys are okay. I mean, they're bad enough. I mean, they're still very intrusive, but they weren't coming to your house to shoot you. You know, is this a compliance thing? You know, are they going to be openly carrying firearms if you go in for an audit? I mean, how is this supposed to work? It's a good thing for DC Project, I think, to tackle.
There's a lot of unknowns there. But it was, when I first read that, I went, what's going on here? And from what I understand, the civilians that they're going after are what, like middle class or $100,000 or something they're supposed to
sure.
be investigating.
Mm-hmm. That's where the money is. Well, as I think Kayleigh McEnany was on Fox News described it best, they're going to do everything they can to get as much money as possible from those earning less than $100,000 so that the rich people can have their tax breaks to buy electric cars. That's what this is about, which is pretty staggering.
Well, here's another thing, too.
Hold on, Pianki. Yeah, so what I said, what Kayleigh McEnany
about the rich people in the college.
Well, what Kayleigh McEnany said was that this is about taxing or going after all the money they can for people making less than $100,000 so that they can use that to subsidize electric cars for the rich. That's what this is about. It's a transfer of wealth to rich people so rich people can buy electric cars. And that's part of it. I mean, that's just one explanation. Well, I think there's a lot more to it than that. What's that, Pierre?
Wouldn't it be something you went to have your car repaired and you had to fill out a little questionnaire on how much you make? And if you made over $400,000, you had to pay more because you can pay more?
Yeah, that's how the progressive tax works. That'd be interesting. I did a paper on that. I wrote an article, and I've forgotten exactly how I did it. It was a graduated cost of living. I think it was from my thing on the conservative response to the minimum wage. I'll get into that later. I'll hold that off. It's an interesting point. Let's wait on that. I want to get back to Shirley because you're dealing with DC Project Women and Guns, and you've got. I mean, are the IRS going to be storming the homes of women at home with their kids? And armed agents going to go, well, I think it's time for an audit. You got a few minutes? I mean, what are they going to do? If they raid Trump's home, why wouldn't they raid anybody's home?
Well, yeah, that's kind of it. If they went to that extreme, anything's possible. And then what Jim was talking about last Friday about the FBI putting out that if you have certain emblems or signs, you're considered a terrorist.
Yeah, if you have anything that represents American freedom, the Betsy Ross flag, the Gadsden "Don't Tread on Me" flag, those are symbols of the Patriot movement, the American firsters, the people that believe in this country, as opposed to the people that they want believing in the government. That's where the problem is. Yeah, I actually post that on our Action Radio Gun Group, and I think Jim is probably going to do it anyway. But it was great to talk about that. He's not here this week, so you get to hang around longer if you want to. So feel free.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought Bianchi was going to jump. He wanted to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bianchi. Did you have a comment? Yeah, go ahead. Bianchi, going once, going twice? No? Okay, fine.
Okay.
Well, let's go into your report. Yep, go for it.
Okay, well, and we'll get started if he needs to jump in with a question or a comment. But, yeah,
he will.
That's going
problem.
On right now is a bit, it's just disturbing. You just wonder what's the motive. Well,
we have a bill.
We
have a disarmament bill. I'll talk about that after your report. But, okay.
So, first of all, the DC Project, my segment, let's go back to that, DC Project Women and Guns. DC Project is a nationwide group of women, and we're out there supporting the Second Amendment. And we're all in different walks of life as well. And this next month we will be going, this will be my first trip to Washington, D.C. to meet with delegates, so it's kind of exciting, and at the same time, what are we getting into? Because I have never been to the meetings that they have, and we've been around 6 years now. They're pretty well coordinated, so yeah, it'll be interesting and exciting at the same time. We do have a rally if anyone's in the D.C. area on September 16th from 1 to 4. We will have a rally. Somewhere around the Capitol. Last meeting we had, I guess they were not allowed to have it where they have had it before on the lawn there. So I guess they're having different rules. So we'll just hopefully everything will go quiet and we'll be safe.
In D.C.?
Yeah.
They hate you. Well, here's a question. Are you going to be actually lobbying? Are you going to be meeting with legislators or legislative staff on bills and issues and things? What's your part in this?
I do know that I'm supposed to be getting a hold of our representatives and trying to set up meetings. I don't really know. We have 15 minutes with either their aides or them. Usually it's the aides, and I guess they have quite a bit of pull. And I gotta just kind of feel it out. We have groups of 4 or 5, sometimes 6, that are going in. And we meet different state representatives. So I think it's more or less to put a face with the women defending the Second Amendment. I don't know how detailed we get. I do know they keep telling us we've got to keep on the time crunch because you don't want to take too much of their time. It's very important to be considerate of that. So it's going to be very interesting after it's all said and done, and I'll be able to tell you what exactly happened during those meetings.
Okay, well, two things. One, do they have training for you before you go in to meet with these people?
What's that?
Is there training, either now or before you get?
Oh yeah,
before you get.
We're doing it. Yeah, we have a lobbyist and she's working with us, and we have a presentation that we went over yesterday. So we're getting there.
Okay.
But a lot of these women have done this before. you know. So we're kind of like the newbies, like I am, because even though I've been with DC Project for a couple of years, the COVID shut down our visits. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
I can help you with the lobbying part. I mean, that's what this whole show is about, you know. But I want
Go
ahead.
We have someone that sets us, you know, kind of gives us the guidelines of how you interact with people. We have a couple reception meetings, and yeah, it'll be interesting. I'll tell you what it's all about after I actually make it through one.
Okay. No, but I would like to know, because like I say, I can help with that, but I really am interested if you can bring on your lobbyists before this event. Not that I want to tell them what I know. I want to find out what they are doing, what they're working on. And I want to suggest our bills that you might be able to incorporate, especially our one to disarm the illegally armed feds, you know, our bureaucratic disarmament.
Right. That might be something we can look at afterwards, because right now I know she's busy along with her own stuff. I mean, she just volunteers with us. She's got her own stuff going on. But, she's busy trying to get us. Hurting 50 women around is going to be very interesting. I don't know how they do it so well.
Well, I can say, but if you're putting six people in an office, that's too many. You need like two. You know, because you have too many people. It looks like, that's just my strategy. I mean, obviously,
normally, yeah, they said 4 to 5. Sometimes you might have 6. But, so I'll let you know how it all goes. Like I said, this is we've been around 6 years. So this is their fourth year doing it then. But what we normally talk about with DC Project is I always have my Teal for Two-Way story, which is a story how someone used a firearm to... How to use a firearm to save their lives or defend their loved ones. And this one takes place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And it occurred at 2 a.m. in this woman's house, and her ex-boyfriend broke in and woke her up abruptly, I'm sure, and started assaulting her. And she was able to get to her firearm, and she was able to shoot him to defend herself. The man was taken to the hospital, no life-threatening injuries. And so I couldn't find – lots of times I like to really look into the articles and get more information, but I couldn't get a whole lot of information on this, or I couldn't find the right place to look, which is sometimes a problem. Hmm. But if you have an ex – I don't know if he had a key. Make sure if there's an ex involved that you always change your locks. And one thing I always do anytime I move, I change the locks. You know, if you're renting, get with the landlord, tell him you need to change the locks, just because you don't know who has copies of the keys that you have.
Yeah, you don't want previous people dropping in.
Exactly. And there's other forms that you can secure your house with. Like I do have a woman that is having an issue, and Sabre has these like door wedge alarms. So if you put, these are also great for college dorms. You know, you can put the wedge at the door, and if someone tries to break in, the alarm goes off. And if you're sleeping, it wakes you up and it startles them. So that's something I think is great for college students, because a lot of colleges, I don't know if there's any you're allowed to carry at right now. Some don't even allow.
I think there's some. I think some of the private colleges you can, but that's a problem. It's a problem in Florida. You know, I know that because we have a bill that was written, Anthony Nunez, when he used to be on the show, PhD electrical engineering student, and he wrote a couple of bills regarding college campus carry because, you know, college students are adults. You know, you can't deny rights for people just because they happen to be in a college. You know, they're customers. They're consumers. They're not children.
Exactly. And some of them are even stricter than others. In Boston, was telling me their daughter's going to Boston New, and he can't even use pepper spray.
Well, of course not, because they value the victim. I mean, they value the criminal more than the victim in Boston. That's part of the problem. That's the whole New England thing. New England fascinates me because here's a place that, you know, when our country was founded, some of the most radical, you know, freedom fighters in the country, Sam Adams, Paul Revere, you know, these folks were New Englanders. What the hell happened? You know, your descendants suck. You know, because they're some of the most strict, you know, gun grabbing, unconstitutional places in the country, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire's okay, Vermont we're not quite sure about. Vermont's like another planet. Maine's pretty good, but Massachusetts, Connecticut, you know, Rhode Island, please. And then the next step from there is New York, and that, we know what that problem is. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I wondered about that, actually. Sometimes I have wondered about that. How did they get to that point? You know?
Well, they adopted socialism. So. You know, that's a really good question. And it's interesting. You look at the coast, you know, Massachusetts, California, the Lake Districts, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin. Some of our older places tend to be the states that developed early. I mean, California's been around for a while. Not as long. Well, I mean, obviously Florida has older places like St. Augustine, 1600s, but Florida, I think, developed more recently a larger amount. And so it seems like the newer states or the slightly less populated or the ones that developed earlier, like California in the 60s, you know, boomed. You know, Florida's booming now. It seems that the later booming states seem to be more conservative, or more conservatives are moving to them. Texas has always been a big state, but I don't think it is an economic powerhouse as big as it is now, you know, maybe 50 years ago, whereas California was. California was huge. People, everybody was going to California, you know, starting after World War II, because they were all there after the war, all the war industries. You know, the whole Pacific War was fought out of, you know, mostly San Francisco. You know, and then L.A. developed afterwards. So, you know, the older states or the earlier developing states for their booms tend to become now more socialist. It seems like that's the evolution. I mean, I'm just making up a theory here, but that's the way it seems to look. What do you think?
Yeah, but if you think about it, that is pretty interesting the way that is true. Hmm. Yeah, California, everybody, even go back to the West, you know, everybody was going to California.
Mm-hmm.
So it started developing long before anybody wanted to go to the swamps of Florida.
Yeah. And then you look, when the people left the socialist areas, they went to Arizona, Texas, Florida, you know, and these are some of the most freedom-loving states. So maybe it's the people that are moving. You know, I always remember when I left, when I moved away from California, you know, and here in my U-Haul, it was like 4 months after open heart surgery. That's a story in itself. But I crossed into Arizona, and I think it whatever border town I spent the night in that night. And I get up the next morning, I go to breakfast at the local diner, and four guys walk in openly carrying 45s cocked and locked. And I went, oh, I'm so happy to be back in America. This is great. You don't see that in California. They would have called the SWAT teams, you know. But in Arizona, you know, you cross the border, you know, and it's just this little sign, you know, you've crossed this, and all of a sudden you're back in America. And you feel it. You can feel the difference between California and Arizona. It was so fast. And here I am with my, you know, my bacon and eggs getting ready for another, you know, 10-hour drive or whatever I was going to do that day. And this guy, four guys walk in. Hey, how you doing, pal? Oh, I'm doing great. Yeah, like the 45s. Yeah, no problem. You know, and then it was hysterical. And the waitress was like, hey guys, how you doing? You know, come on and sit down. And it was just something. It was like another world to see that. It was so nice to see people openly carrying firearms. I thought, well, I'm really secure here. This is great. I got four guys armed with 45s. Pianchi?
That should be more the rule than the exception. I keep harping on that.
No, you're right.
Things that you want to see, things that you want to have, you got to do yourself. You can't tell somebody to do something that you're not willing to do.
Yeah. Well, let's ask Shirley, is there any kind of normalization of firearms program? In other words, encouraging open carry where constitutional carry exists, especially for women. You know, you see women carrying more guns, which is traditionally, you know, a male thing, which is kind of stupid, especially with the rise of women gun owners. But wouldn't it make more sense, you know, if you had your DC project and openly carrying a firearm, or maybe not have your DC project here, but just at least openly carrying a firearm? Would you encourage that, or what do you think? Surely.
No, I have no problem with open carry. I think it's a lot has to do with the person that's carrying, what they're comfortable mm-hmm. with. I should think, like Bianchi said, everyone should be allowed to do such a thing if they choose to. But
well,
I
he's saying more though. And I agree with Bianchi on this one too. We've both talked about this. The normalization. You want to make the sight of firearms normal. It's normal on police. People don't think twice about seeing a police officer with a gun.
Exactly.
Well, I think it would be beneficial to see, you know, just us regular folks with a gun. That would be just as normal. You know, so when two people walk into a store, police officer walks into a store carrying a gun, you know, a citizen walks into a store carrying a gun. Hey, how you doing, officer? Oh, fine. How are you today? Oh, great. You know, that should be a normal event.
Well, and I agree. And the mentality that people have, just like you're saying, when I went to Alabama for the Bama carry, and I walk into a hotel and I see all these guys open carrying, I went, huh, isn't this cool? And,
it is cool.
But other people, and that's just the people that are in the gun community that support the Second Amendment, and they go, wow, that's pretty cool. But the people that are the anti-Second Amendment people, the anti-gunners, the people that are let media throw so much fear into their heads, all they see is that thing, and they get all scared. I'm like, but most times the people that are against the Second Amendment, against defending ourselves, are the most violent and vicious and vocal. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing if people would actually really look and think about that. Just like when I went to the NRA meeting in Houston, they were awful. They were just nasty, saying nasty things. And I'm like, really? Come on. And here we are. We're just standing there looking at them like, really? Are you really going to sit over there and just scream and holler at us?
So, well, those people shouldn't carry guns. They're obviously too violent. They're not in control of their emotions. They have no business carrying firearms. But they have no business telling you that you can't.
Yeah, they got a mental problem. And you know, when you went in there and you seen the guns that people was carrying, you said, oh, that is cool. Well, see, when it become normal, you would look at the gun and say, this fool doesn't know how to clean his weapon. Look how dirty it is. So that's the difference
in the perception.
Hey, Bianca,
don't talk about me like that.
Well, it's fascinating that the left uses this argument that, well, and this judge actually said this in California against open carry. When open carry was outlawed, we used to do it. We actually had meetings in restaurants, and we'd call a restaurant ahead, and 50 of us would show up openly carrying, and the police would be there too. They wanted to check that our guns were unloaded. You can't carry – at that time, you couldn't carry a loaded gun openly, but you could carry an unloaded one and have your magazines on the other side. Okay, fine. I can live with that for a while. But the thing was that the restaurants loved it. I mean, the restaurants, they never had so much business as when the open carry folks were there. So they actually loved it. But it's really interesting to see a restaurant with over half the people in it openly carrying firearms. And we talked to families. We'd sit down on tables and say, hey, guys, what do you think of this? They're like, you know, this is kind of cool. It took a minute to get used to, but – you know, now that we're here, this is the safest restaurant in the San Francisco Bay Area right now. It sure is. So we're all armed. We're all here. You know, so it was fascinating. But the people, and here's an argument for you when the left comes up and says, well, people don't feel safe, you know, with you carrying firearms. And it's like, okay, that's all right. They're allowed to not feel safe. You know, well, they're afraid if you're carrying firearms. And that's okay. They're allowed to be afraid. But it has nothing to do with my rights. You know, my rights are not dependent or, you know, on them, on their emotions. They can, whatever emotions they have, that's fine. You know, the government's not going to control their emotions. You know, they said, but they can control our firearms rights, and that they can't do. That's unconstitutional, and that's illegal. So these people, they're free to be as afraid as they want. They should deal with that, you know, and they can feel as uncomfortable or whatever as they want. They should deal with that too. That has nothing to do with me and my rights. So if you can separate emotions from rights on that basis, so let them be afraid. That's okay. Let them be offended. That's okay too. Doesn't affect me at all or my rights.
Exactly.
What do you think?
And you can also pertain that to, you know, everybody's sexual choice. You know, maybe some people will get offended because someone's a gay, you know, so, but that doesn't stop them from the right to do it. You know,
unless you discriminate. And that's the same thing with gun owners. If you discriminate against gun owners, if you discriminate against gay people, if you discriminate against anybody that you think is different, if you discriminate against conservatives because you don't like their ideology, it's still discrimination. So I absolutely agree with you.
Exactly.
And you can feel what you want. You can feel what you want about another person, but you can't inflict upon yourself upon their rights. Now, I think that'd be a fabulous argument for DC Project to make, to really make that clear. That when someone says, "Oh, we're afraid. We don't feel safe. We don't feel this. We don't feel that." It's like, well, that's okay. Not a problem. You can not feel safe. That's all right. That's your choice. I think that's
exactly
a huge thing to talk about for DC Project.
Exactly, and there's people out there that if you put a firearm down on the desk, they'd be like, "Oh my gosh!" The first thing they think of, "Oh, someone, you're going to shoot somebody." I see that, and I went, "Oh, I can go out and I can." You know, do some IDPA, USPSA. I can do some shooting sports. Mm-hmm. I have a way to defend myself. You know, it's just the mentality of what people see, and I think a lot of that pertains to the media perception, what the media and what certain politicians want you to believe, and they put it through the media, and they call it the Moms Demand Action. They call gun control, gun safety. That's not the way it works. They want people to believe that gun control is a form of gun safety. Gun safety and gun control are two different things in my book.
Well, then you ask them, well, what do you mean by gun safety? I mean, guns have Consumer Product Safety Commission rules. The safeties on the guns have to work. you know, they can't be fired when they're dropped. There's a certain amount of things that they can't do, but they do have to fire intended so they can save people's lives. So what makes a gun safe is that it works, because then it's safe to save lives. You know, so there are ways you could turn all these arguments around. You just have to have them in your head ahead of time. But I think if you can get
like hunter safety.
Hunter safety, same thing.
Like hunter, yes.
Go ahead. But you got to have
the
gun
before
groups.
You can get a hunter license, you have to attend a, you know, funny thing about that, which Jim was here today, you have to attend a hunter safety class. If not, you don't get the license.
See, but you don't want to license gun carrying because it's a right. And hunting is different. Yeah, you know, I still think people have a right to hunt. But the thing is, if you're doing wildlife management and things like that, it's a different kind of thing. It's not a self-defense, self-preservation thing. So hunting and defending yourself are different. Whereas, you know, we all believe in constitutional carry. I don't have a problem with hunting classes and hunting licensing to the point, and hunting fees, because that helps conservation land. That's actually the biggest environmental preservationists are the hunters. They're the ones who get the land set aside. But that's a different kind of thing than a right. Bianca, do you see the distinction I'm making? Does that make sense? Or do you have a question?
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. See what you're saying, but I'm saying that in order to be able to participate, you have to have taken these courses. You know, for instance, the information on how many ducks you can harvest in one day, or how many rabbits you can harvest in one day, or
well, see,
how many in your shotgun, how many shells can you have available to be fired?
Yeah, but you wouldn't want people saying, you know, how big a gun could you carry? How many rounds could it be? Or how many other things like that? Or how long you have to have your concealed permit before you can exercise it? Or how many classes you have to take? You know, so if something's a right, it's different. Hunting is not a defined right in the Constitution or even the state constitutions, as far as I know. But it's easy to do it after you've had a few classes. So that makes sense to me. I don't have a problem with that, because I don't want every animal shot up and killed and lose a bunch of species. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you don't want to have a lot of hunting accidents, neither.
Well, that's
you
true.
Know, there's a lot of things. In order to participate in that activity, there's a lot of things that a person who just getting involved need to know. How do you cross a fence with a loaded rifle? That's a particular way. How do you, when you're going up into your tree stand, how do you convey your rifle up to that tree stand? So, yes, there's a lot to learn,
well, yeah,
a lot to know.
But in the same way, well, let's bring it back to Shirley here, because, you know, you're a firearms instructor. And I know classes are obviously a good idea, and a lot of responsible gun owners take them. How much would you require? In other words, would you have a required class to constitutionally carry, for example? In other words, anybody can carry. We're not forcing you to do this. But do you think some kind of a class – like some kind of certificate of ability. So we're not licensing you. We're not making you get a permit to carry, but we're saying that you should get a certificate. Like a pilot's license is not a license. It's actually a certificate, and it proves your competency to engage in flying. Would you think something like that should be good for constitutional carry, or just highly recommended?
Well, sure. I think you'd have to highly recommend it if you're going constitutional, because once again, I'm going to play the devil's advocate here a little bit, because you're saying that I can constitutionally carry, but then you're telling me I have to take a class. That sounds a little bit like, I don't know, it's mm-hmm. a little confusing there. I highly recommend anybody do any training that they can, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it can be required and still be called constitutional carry. And then also on the hunting thing, it sounds a little odd. I mean, I don't hunt. I plan to do that one of these days. But if I have to take a hunting class, but yet I'm not required to, like if I was constitutionally carrying, I'm not required to take a class. Does that mean that it's more important that I know stuff when I hunt than when I defend myself? I don't know. It just sounds a little odd. Sounds like the hunting is more important.
Actually, it's the same. Like, for instance, if you're doing defense firearms training under situations and in training in those classes, it gives you recommendations on your stance, how to take cover, of what to look for, and so on and so on and so on. Well, the same thing is in hunting. If you're hunting, for instance, a boar or ferals, well, you will learn where you have to hit that animal in order to stop him. If you don't, it will continue to come on and could possibly do damage to you or even kill you.
Exactly. I agree. And I understand that. But you were saying that I'm required to take a class if I go hunting, but I'm not required to take a class if I am constitutionally carrying. I agree. I think everybody should know how to handle the firearm safely and know about how to, you know, defend yourself. I agree totally.
I know in Missouri, for you to get a hunting license to hunt, you have to take a class, a gun safety, and so on.
Yeah, but hunting's not a right, not a defined right. Now, you might disagree with that and argue. I don't want to spend time on hunting. I want to get some other issues here. The point is that, and that was kind of a loaded question I asked, because I don't want to see mandatory classes either, because the government will use, if it's mandatory, that means the government controls it. If the government controls it, they could do like New York does and make the classes so tough that nobody can pass. That's another, it's like backdoor gun confiscation, registration, limiting the exercise of your right. That's what New York's doing right now. They say, well, they have to issue permits, but they're making the permits impossible to get. They set the criteria so high. So the same problem would be in a class. Now, the question is, highly recommended. I think that I wish the gun companies would have a certificate for first-time gun owners, of their products that would cover part of the cost of a gun lesson, for example, or the gun stores themselves, if they had a range back, say, look, if you're new, let's give you a lesson here. Let's, $25. We'll teach you for whatever, I don't know what the going rate is, but or we'll call one of our instructors. And ideally they'd be in the store at the time, so people could actually have a lesson right then and there. So there are ways to do this. I wouldn't mandate it, but I would highly recommend it. And I think anybody who's responsible would do that. So is there any statistics on that, on the rate of new gun owners that take instruction? Are there anything you have on that?
Not that I know of, and I don't really know there's a way to trace that either. Because, then you're questioning people and, did you take a class? And you're like, what is it in your business?
Yeah, that's true, too. Well, I don't know if they just register the number of classes. You could take the number of people registered for classes and compare that to the number of people who bought guns. That wouldn't be too hard to figure out.
My grandson to his first weapon, but I told him, you're going to take some classes on gun safety and others. And, that should be a normal thing to do. The same thing with driving a car. A fishing license, they have a book. When you catch a fish, if it's within a certain limits of dimensions, then you can keep it. If not, you got to throw it back into the water. So there's regulations that go along with all those things. I understand what you're saying, but you're talking about particular activity. Now, guess what? On your land, you can shoot deer all year long. But off your land, there's a gun season, then there's a bow season that you're allowed to hunt deer in many states.
Now, is there any restriction on hunting, especially if there's an endangered species, say like elk are limited in your particular area? Could they limit the hunting of elk on your land, or is every elk fair game, for example?
I don't know. I don't have any elk in my state.
I just picked that as the first animal that popped into my head. All right. Well, Shirley, here's another thing, too, because we have a gun bill that offers tax deductions and tax credits for the purchase of guns, ammo, and for classes. So you could tell people, and especially DC Project folks, and this is, I'm hoping they'll advance our bill, that if we had a bill that not only encouraged, gun classes, made them tax deductible or even a tax credit, that might encourage a lot more people to take classes who might have a financial, maybe they can just afford the gun and they can't afford the extra classes, which is kind of stupid. But it might be more incentive to get classes. Look, this is, you get a tax credit for this. That would be huge.
Oh, yeah. And then, now we're getting back to the IRS.
How about that?
We just made a complete
But we've got a bill for that. In fact, I've got a disarmament bill, and I've got a bill that advances, tax credits and tax deductions for, as the liberals would say, access to quality firearms and ammunition. But it includes hunting classes, concealed carry classes, any kind of training, ammo and guns. That'd be a great bill to take to Washington. Great bill. That's a hint, by the way.
Yeah.
That's a big hint.
Yeah.
Big hint.
I got that. Totally. I got that.
Okay, good. Just want to check.
Let's see.
What else you got?
Okay. Well, do you know Marion? Have you heard of Marion Hammer?
Oh, of course. She's like,
Ms.
NRA in Florida. Yeah.
Right. You know, everybody said, oh, of course, except for, you know, me. I learned about her after I got
well,
into
the actually,
project.
I had her on my show.
Because you don't.
She was on. She was on with me on WBY, you know, way back in 2017, 2018. She was on my show. So I've talked to her.
Yeah. So apparently she's just one little fireball. But she's
oh, yeah.
retiring. Did you know that? Yeah.
Oh, the hammer's retiring? Oh, my goodness.
Well, I know, and from what I understand, that's not really good for Florida. I don't know. I hope she's grooming somebody. But apparently, for anyone that doesn't know who Marianne Hammer is, because I learned a lot about her, I did a little research on her.
Mm-hmm.
She is retiring. She's a Florida lobbyist for the NRA. But
mm-hmm.
that's not all. This woman has done a lot.
Mm-hmm. Do tell.
She's 83 years old.
Wow.
She spent 44 years as a lobbyist for the NRA, and one of the comments was that she helped earn Florida the Gunshine State. I thought that was pretty cute.
Yeah, well, that's back when we had when Florida was advancing concealed carry shall issue. Florida was the first state to do that. Florida led the way.
Yeah.
You know, with shall issue permits, and then they lost their way. And I don't know whether Marion Hammer or the NRA did the NRA restrict Marion Hammer? Did Marion Hammer, you know, lose some enthusiasm in her 80s? You know, I don't know. I mean, I would probably.
But she
yeah.
apparently was
yeah.
She was involved in that, highly involved in getting that. But
mm-hmm.
she did you know she has a trademark? I got it.
No.
I thought it was pretty cute.
What's
yeah,
that?
She's got her bowl-shaped gray haircut,
mm-hmm.
bright blue or red blazer, and soft southern drawl. And she's only like, she's less than 5 foot tall.
Oh
but
yeah, barely 5 foot. Yeah, she or yeah, she's. But everybody knows. Well, I mean, you do now. But yeah, Marion Hammer is extremely well known in the Florida gun world. I don't think the problem is Marion Hammer. I think the problem is the NRA. I don't know if the NRA backed her as much. I don't know if the NRA supported her. I think that if Marion Hammer had her way, we would have had constitutional carry the year after we had concealed carry, shall issue. I think that her heart was in the right place, her efforts were in the right place, but I don't think the NRA supported her because I don't think the NRA is the best backer of the Second Amendment. You never hear about them in the forefront of any gun issue anymore. It's groups like you guys, Gun Owners of America, you know, Second Amendment Foundation. It's never the NRA.
Yeah, I wonder that too. They don't seem to be as forward as, like I said, I'm new to the. Lots of times I'll text Jim and I'll say, how do you know all this stuff? Well, he's been a Second Amendment advocate a lot longer than I have. I've only got a couple years into
it. Well, your perspective is great, though. It's because you're new that your perspective is so valuable. You know, as a new gun owner, as a new person in this, as a new instructor, I mean, this is great. The fact that you became a gun owner and an instructor is great. And that perspective is valuable.
Yeah. Well, here's another cute fact you might not know about, or maybe you do because you had her on the show. So in 1978, she was hired by the NRA. Do you know what she was given one mission. I think this is a great mission. And her mission do you remember that?
No, I just started college then. I didn't know anything about Florida. I was in Massachusetts. I was talking about socialists. They didn't even talk about guns.
No, you had her on the show. I thought maybe she'd share this. But her one mission was for her. They gave her this mission. Do what you need to do, but do not let Florida become another California.
That's a great mission.
Her mission for me.
Yeah, no, I don't remember that. No, we didn't talk about that. She wasn't on that line. I don't remember her having like a whole hour or anything like that. I think it was a brief report, but I do remember talking to her. And so I'd have to go check the archives, as they say. But she's not one of my big featured interviews. But she was making the rounds and calling the shows and lobbying for something at the time, probably constitutional carry. This would have been 2017, 2018, somewhere in there. But, she's still pretty active.
Recently.
I was recently, yeah.
Well,
kind
of recent.
Yeah.
I call it kind of recent.
Yeah, she's still probably in her 70s, late 70s, yeah.
So she's done a lot of things. She was the first female president of the NRA,
mm-hmm.
and that was in 96. She helped create the Eddie Eagle Gun Safety Course.
Mm-hmm.
And for anybody that doesn't know that kind of, you teach kids from, I think, kindergarten to fourth grade, to sixth grade, something like that, what to do when you come across a gun. You, how does it go? Stop, don't touch, run away, and get an adult.
Yep.
Tell a grown-up. So that was something big that she's done. And my goal is to, she's still going to stay as a consultant with the NRA, but my goal is to actually go up there to Tallahassee and meet her sometime, see if I can find someone that to hook me up. And I think we have someone that I know in the NLA.
Well, you know, my next question is, why don't you bring her on the show? Let's get her on for an hour. Let's get all that worldly wisdom, that experience, that lobbying experience. I mean, she'd be the best person to talk to before you go to Washington, quite honestly. Decades of experience. Yeah.
Yeah, that Eddie Eagle should be mandatory in all schools.
Once the government controls it, they'll change it. They'll talk about how guns are evil and guns are bad, and they'll change the whole emphasis of the program.
Eddie Eagle is like she just described. My grandson used to go to elementary schools, and while he was in high school, he would go to elementary schools and give that lecture.
I agree.
Second, third, fourth grade school.
It should be done, but the same problem with classes being mandatory, the government would control them. If the government takes over the Eddie the Eagle program, what do you think it's going to turn into?
Here's the thing with schools, Greg. If you live in a school district, you the parents, you the stakeholders, you can demand whatever you want your children to be taught in that school district. The government has nothing to do with it. People get this concept, this notion that the federal government controls public schools. They do not. Only if they are asked to come in and install a program like ROTC or something of that nature. But federal government had no control. I know some public school districts, Clayton, Ladue, in the St. Louis area, that the federal government better not come up in there walking saying what's going to happen and what ain't going to happen.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about the federal government so much. I was thinking of any government, even the school board. Would they change the Eddie the Eagle program? I think it should be in the schools. I think it's a great program. I'm nothing against the Eddie Eagle program.
Yeah.
My concern is that it would be changed.
Too.
Yeah, okay.
Another thing, too, is that it's printed material, and many state legislatures have provided grants for school districts to be able to programs that want to have that where they can get dollars to acquire the material, which is basically nothing but coloring books. I like coloring books myself, crayons.
I haven't tried one for a while, but yeah. Well, here's an idea, Shirley, for the DC project. You know, we have Black History Month, we have Gay Pride Month, we have things like that. You know, I don't know if we need a month. Well, maybe we have a month. You know, but Women in Guns Month or Women in Guns Week or something like that.
We talked about that, and I was working on that. Submitted that. Yeah, I've looked into researching how you do that. It's not like a national. There's apparently, it's just like it's an organization, and you put an application in, and they decide. It's not like a federal holiday. It's kind of like, I don't know, like National Ice Cream Day. But I did look into that, and I did submit that to see, and we haven't come up with an actual response on that.
Okay. You're still getting the follow-up for all these ideas. I appreciate it. Yeah. That's great.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that'd be great. I'd like to do that for a whole month, like Gun Save Lives Month. We talked about that, what to call it, too. Go ahead, Bianchi. And Bianchi, do you stay inside the line? Just checking.
And you know how to do it? Go to some of these black groups that's teaching Black History Month and so on, and say, hey, could you help us teach this? Because they have access to the schools in the urban areas, per se, and they have already worked out the politics. So just introduce them to your idea, your program, and let them carry it out. They would be more than happy to.
Do you know who you should talk to, Shirley? Yes. Talk to Maj Touré. He was on the show, I think, maybe 3 weeks ago. Black Guns Matter?
Yeah.
Talk to him.
And
you're a reporter for Action Radio, and see if that gets you anywhere, hopefully. Yeah,
I've met him before. And also, we've got Rhonda, too. So, yeah, that's a good idea. We don't have to reinvent the wheel every time to find out how to have a month
Rhonda,
or
we should get back
a
more
day
often.
Or
I'm sorry.
Yeah, she's pretty cool.
Yeah. I want to make sure we cover your report. In a few minutes, what I want to do, because Derek's going to be on and then Amber's going to take up the next hour. We have Amber Kemper coming back from her Patriot Academy in the Austin, Texas Capitol. And so we're going to get an update on that, plus any constitutional stuff we want to talk about. But I want to make sure I get in our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece before 7:30, so we've got about 15 minutes. So let's take another 5-6 minutes for your show and for your report, and then unless you've got it covered. But,
That was it. I just wanted to touch base on what a little spitfire Marion was. And, it just takes someone to be dedicated to preserving the Constitution, the Second Amendment. And I think a lot more women out there, just like Bianchi says, and we talked about the school board and schools, I think parents are realizing that. And I think a lot of mothers and women are running for school board and taking control over the schools again, because at one point you just kind of assumed that the schools had the best interest of your kids in mind, which apparently they've learned differently now. So, just one by one, standing up. We had, like I said before, we've had women running for office from the D.C. Project. So I think, we're just doing it one by one, one step at a time. And I'll go ahead and do my closing now, and then I can hang on for just a few more minutes. But, so this is Shirley Watchell. I'm with DC Project, Women in Gun Rights. If you have any questions or you're interested in making any donations or joining our group, you can go to dcproject.info. And as stated in the very beginning, I am a firearms instructor. You can find my Facebook page at Shirley Watchell, Firearms Instructor. And also, if you would like to get in touch with me, you can just email me at dcpflstatedirector@gmail.com. And that's my report. This is Shirley Watchell reporting for Action Radio, DC Project, Women and Guns.
She's a book author, too. What's the name of your book, Shirley?
See that? I should write this stuff down. And
you need a byline.
I've written a book. It's called Heels to Holster. It's about my survival of incident of domestic violence and how I went from victim to warrior and claimed my life back. You can get that on Amazon. And once again, that's Heels to Holster.
Mm-hmm. That's how I put most of that information, I think, in your intro. I got one question. I want to see if Bianchi has a question, first of all. Bianchi, do you have one last question for Shirley? Going once, going twice? Okay. My question is, if you get a chance to talk to Marion Hammer, find out any insights you can from her. And this is why I'd love to have her on the show, as to what happened to Florida and why we don't have constitutional carry and why we have this ridiculous bill, the Do Something Bill, after the Stoneman Douglas assassinations, that changed the laws. You took away gun rights from 18 to 21 year olds. They had some other stuff. They had red flag laws, this other stuff. It's actually in the Constitution. We need to get rid of all that stuff, but she'd be great for insight into how that happened, how Florida lost its way, and what we can do about it. That'd be my interest.
There was a comment, because there was one of the articles where they talked about the red flag and she had some really great comments, and I didn't get to all of them, but sweeping school safety, the red flag in the 18 to 20 year olds at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But here's what she says. This is a betrayal of law-abiding gun. When she talked about lowering the age and the red flag, this is a betrayal of law-abiding gun owners who did absolutely nothing. All the laws in place to identify and stop this kind of activity failed. So since they can't actually punish those failures, they're going to punish law-abiding gun owners. And of course, we always obey the law. So they don't have to worry about us before or after they pass this gratuitous gun control. And that was in 2018, that was her comment to those two, the lowering of the raising of the age and the red flag. So, she seems to be like she's a wealth of information. And
well, you may get her as an advisor. She may want to be an advisor to the DC Project, especially since you're in Florida, you're the Florida chair. She
could be my advisor. I need all the help I can get.
No, I'm serious. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Ask her if she might be honored to be your advisor. You never know. I would ask her.
Yeah, I would love that. That's a great idea. So I just have to do some homework and get some contact information and get my butt to work on that.
Yep, but, and then bring her on the show.
Yeah, hey, yeah exactly.
I love your report, and you're doing a fabulous job, and keep going. And especially, I'm really interested in watching this stuff.
Before you leave, you might want to check of that group there in St. Petersburg, and they had an office there, and they had an office in St. Louis, and was raided by the FBI. It's a black group, led by Joe Waller, and I can't think of the name of the group right now. It's called Uhuru. And you know the funny thing about this group? Yes. Funny thing about them is that when Obama was running for president, and they had a he had a rally there in St. Petersburg, I believe it was, and members of that group gave him a lot of trouble asking questions. And what I'm wondering is this Garland coming back at them with the raise they had the other day simultaneously in these two cities, St. Petersburg and St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah, that's a little different issue than I think, Shirley. Well, Shirley, do you have a quick comment on that? And then I want to get to a play something. That's a big topic you just raised.
What was the name of the group?
Uhuru.
Uhurus.
Oh.
See, now I remember them from college. When I was in college at the University of Massachusetts, the Uhuru House, so they've been around for a while. You know, this is back in the early 80s. They were a black separatist house. It was only for black students. You know, white students couldn't even go in. It was one of the early segregation separatist places on campus, starting on liberal college campuses. And we all made fun of it. I remember there was something in the college newspaper or something. Whatever it was, I was a target for a while, too. I was like, wait a minute, I can't have a separate house. You know, why can't we have the White House? Everybody got mad at me. But, yeah, that's they're a separatist organization. I mean, that's
yeah, I don't know anything about that. So I'll do some research on that, too.
Okay. Well, Pianki, if you want to tell me more about the story, not right now, but that's certainly an issue that we should raise probably the last part of the show today or next week. It'd be interesting to learn more about the Uhurus and what happened to Obama, because it wouldn't surprise me if the IRS is investigating them because Obama got pissed off. I mean, that's what he does. He goes after conservatives. He goes after political enemies. That's why the IRS should be chair of the IRS or should be an elected position. Wouldn't that be interesting? All right, let me play something.
Back I can see what he was doing. They were trying to make him commit openly in public at a microphone what he was going to do for blacks, and he didn't do it.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, let me play something, and we'll be right back, and we've got Derek coming in just a few minutes, too.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Federalist Paper No. 13 was written by Alexander Hamilton and published November 28, 1787. It is titled Advantage of the Union in Respect to Economy in Government. In the very first paragraph, he says, in part, as connected with the subject of revenue, we may with propriety consider that of economy. If the states are united under one government, there will be but one national civil list to support. So right from the very beginning, Hamilton characterizes the states as united under one government. This is outrageous. The whole foundation of the United States is that they are individual and independent states first, united only because they happen to be next to each other on the same piece of continent. But in every other aspect, the states are as independent countries, except for a very few areas which are to be delegated to the federal government through the Constitution that the Federalists are allegedly trying to advocate. But you can see right here why there was so much objection to the Constitution from the anti-Federalists, who didn't mind the idea of the Constitution so much as long as the spirit of the Constitution matched the independence and self-governance of the states declared in the Articles of Confederation. It is apparent that the Federalists wanted to unite the states as subordinate and subservient parts of the whole United States, which are united not by, but under a strong national top-down government. You can clearly see in this one sentence why the anti-federalists were so strongly opposed to the completely new status of the states under the Constitution as outlined in these papers by the Federalists. Then Hamilton says, "The entire separation of the states into 13 unconnected sovereignties is a project too extravagant and too replete with danger to have many advocates. In other words, the United States as constituted is really too dangerous an idea because the states can't be trusted to be independent states. They have to be controlled by the national government lest they become a few factions and then, in Hamilton's own words, dangerous." Dangerous to whom? He and his fellow Federalists of the self-appointed elite? One could only assume so. Hamilton revives the often repeated theme that the states can't be trusted to remain independent and individual. They will, as all states have done in Europe, create various factions. Hamilton bases his arguments on this imaginary projection of how he thinks the states will group and makes that the reason the federal government must rule the states. He groups the 13 states like this. "The ideas of men who speculate upon the dismemberment of the empire seem generally turned towards three confederacies, one consisting of the four northern, another of the four middle, and a third of the five southern states." He even defeats his own argument with the admission that this is speculation. And what is this talk of us being an empire? Hamilton says, "No well-informed man will suppose that the affairs of such a confederacy can be properly regulated by a government less comprehensive in its organs or institutions than that which has been proposed by the convention." In other words, if you don't agree with him, you are an idiot because you aren't well-informed. Heard that theme from government all the time. In Hamilton's warped mind of pretty much imposing a British monarchy on the states, wrapped in flowery language, he describes the hierarchy under his constitution. He says, "Civil power, properly organized and exerted, is capable of diffusing its force to a very great extent and can, in a manner, reproduce itself in every part of a great empire by a judicious arrangement of subordinate institutions." Or, to put this in modern English, we need a government big enough to be in every state and locality with enough agencies and departments to control everything. Unfortunately, he got his wish, and here we are. Eventually, Hamilton engages in the topic for which he titled his Federalist paper, the economy. However, an analysis of the last paragraph will display an arrogance and a plan not to advance the economy for the benefit of all through free markets, where the federal government would standardize only what is necessary between the states to keep the free flow of goods and services moving, with things like consistent taxes, laws, and even train track widths. No, what Hamilton is really worried about is a free economy among the independent states where the feds don't get their share of revenue, taxes, or control. Hamilton concludes Federalist 13 with this. "If, in addition to the consideration of a plurality of civil lists, we take into view the number of persons who must necessarily be employed to guard the inland communication between the different confederacies against illicit trade, and who, in time, will infallibly spring up out of the necessities of revenue, and if we also take into view the military establishments, which it has been shown would unavoidably result from the jealousies and conflicts of the several nations into which the states would be divided, we shall clearly discover that a separation would be not less injurious to the economy than to the tranquility, commerce, revenue, and liberty of every part." The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers, Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities, and then there are the markets. Oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park of Edward Jones Financial Advisors joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money.
Oh, I'm so glad inflation is zero. I was really getting worried about it, Derek, but I don't have to worry anymore because Brandon said we're done. So nice. I should do the applause. I need like a let's ring the Chinese gong, you know, to celebrate. Where's my gong here? I got to find these things faster anyway. But yeah, and this is for Brandon. Thank you, Brandon. And thank China too. No inflation.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think the other comment is 0% inflation, and the definition of inflation is not two consecutive quarters.
That's recession.
There's or two negative consecutive quarters. There's a thing going around with Clinton, you know, on video saying what the definition of a recession is, and like, you know, they're passing it around, and they're like, she says this is not the definition of a recession, and then Clinton pops on and says that's two negative quarters.
Well, I mean, there's so many quarters. You know, this is something that's really fascinating about politics, and this has only happened in the last few years. But there's these instant recalls, these nexus searches, or whatever they do, and they do the keyword, and you can pull up anybody's speech from any time. You know, they couldn't do this before. So people used to get away, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they get away with making outrageous statements. Unless you had a really good memory, you know, you couldn't find it, or you'd have to go on the microfiche. You know, you'd have to look up in a library, and you have to find the article and the quotes and do it that way. Now they just punch up a computer. So, well, this isn't what you said, you know, 5 minutes ago. You said this. You know, oh, geez, sorry. Or 10 years ago or other people. But yeah, so but this is Orwellian, you know, the idea of changing the language. You know, in a way, like I said, the definition of administration, you know, it's when the Marxists steal the government and put a moron in the White House. That's the new definition for administration. And they keep going. They keep changing the language.
So if you go to Investopedia, which has normally been a very good guide to things that are going on, you know, if you do research and pull the topic, their definition was updated July 29th, 2022.
Oh, they changed it.
It doesn't say change. It says update.
Well, that's a redefinition too. You know, so updated to what? Why would you need to update the definition of recession? The current one works just fine.
Yeah. And then the definition on whitehouse.gov was updated July 21st, 2022. That was the day after they posted the results. What was the other one I found?
Well, don't keep me in suspense. What are the new definitions? What are they saying? Do you have them?
What's that?
Do you have the actual, do they have their made up new definitions?
No, nobody seems to, but you know, I mean, when you talk about a recession, what they really look for, I mean, obviously you've got the two negative quarters of GDP. You know, there's other things that they want to see. They want to see high unemployment. They want to see, you know, consumer confidence extremely low, you know, consumer spending low, you know, production low. There's a lot of other things that they want to see that comes with the negative quarters, but they're not required. we have a chart that we look at that's called bulls and bears, right? And what it does is it takes all the bull markets and it kind of draws a line in the middle and it points them up. And then it takes all the bear markets and it points them down. You can adequately see how big each of them are, you know, knowing that the bulls outweigh the bears, right? And then typically on this chart is a nice little shaded area that shows where the recessions are, right? And, you know, you can easily identify the Great Depression, easily identify 2008, 2009, and you can easily identify the one in the 80s, right? You know, those are the really only three exceptions. All the rest of them look like little slivers of shaded area. when we update the chart for 2022, I am 99.9% sure that there's going to be a shaded area in 2022.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, right. Because those definitions have never changed for the financial industry, right? You know, the fact that we have not produced gross domestic product for 6 months is what meets the definition for the financial industry. Unless, of course, they're going to change, you know. So, I mean, I doubt that's going to happen when these charts are produced and we see our new chart. I mean, I'm pretty sure that you know, this is going to be a nice little shaded area for us.
Well, yeah, but so there's the change in the definition for political and propaganda purposes than actually going into the economic texts, the economic dictionaries, and changing the definition, like the WHO changed the definition of herd immunity. Herd immunity is when the majority of people are immune to a disease. They've developed a natural immunity to it. It has nothing to do with vaccines. So the WHO, the World Health Organization, goes in and says, well, our new definition, and they actually rewrote it. Okay, so you have to have the old one. This is why I want to go buy an old 1800s dictionary, so at least I have a record of what words used to mean, you know, before the Orwellian let's change the words. But they actually changed it to say that only through vaccine, you know, when a majority of people are vaccinated, do you achieve herd immunity. Well, that's a completely different thing. You know, it's like saying that marriage includes gay marriage. Well, it doesn't. Marriage is marriage. Marriage already has a definition. You know, however you feel about it doesn't matter. The definition of marriage still exists and has for thousands of years. So I don't want you messing around with my language, you know. And the same thing here with the recession. Now, the recession should be defined as being 6 months old in the end of the second quarter of a contraction.
Oh,
that
would
be a more accurate
sure.
statement, because we've talked about that.
Well, I mean, everything that they report is a lagging indicator. So, you know, I mean, it's by the time, and I guess the better way to put it is by the time, you know, the recession is announced, you know, the way the timeline, most of them happen, the recovery begins shortly thereafter, you know, so,
yeah.
Not
in this case.
You know, for people,
they're just an inflation bill. Well, yeah.
Really,
I'm
what
sorry.
The government has done by not saying that we've entered recession is by saying, okay, well, fine, we're going to keep you in fear, and we got to kick the can down the road. Which would you rather want? You know what I mean? Think about that.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. You know, they don't. Not only are they not dealing with it, they're making it worse with the Green New Deal, Build Back Better, Inflation Reduction, Hyperinflation Act. They're actually going to make this worse. I mean, the worst thing you do during a recession and an inflationary period is raise taxes and spend a bunch more money, which means more borrowing, which means more printing, which means more inflation. So not only have they changed the definition, they've done the worst possible thing they could based on their changed definition, because they don't accept they don't do the reality. They're just doing what they want to do.
Yeah, it's no big deal. They'll just blame Trump.
Well,
it's worked out so well
so
far.
Did that rock the markets at all? That Trump was invaded? I mean, are any of the CEOs on Wall Street, maybe conservative people that contributed to Trump, are they wondering if they're going to get invaded? I mean, how does this affect the markets at all?
I doubt it.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of a blip on the map. I mean, yesterday the market actually started a pretty big rally, and then you know, the unemployment filing numbers was 15,000 or 14,000 over what they expected, which is really nothing. So the market reacted a little negative, and then mortgages crept over 5% again. So the market reacted negative and just kind of stayed right there on the line yesterday. So the market seems to still be hypersensitive to very basic news. You know, in an economy when we're moving along and there's no issues, this type of news is nothing. You know, I mean, the market would perpetuate and be green through it. But you know, even the remote small amount of news seems to have a, I don't want to call it a drastic impact, but has an impact on the market.
Have all the COVID lockdown jobs, are they back? And are they using that to say that we have a growth in jobs when they really just have a restoration of jobs that were taken away?
I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, that's, you know, of course, you know, the White House wanted to take credit for that. And if you go look at the Twitter, you know, I mean, the most loved comments are, you know, basically, hey, thanks for bringing all our jobs back. You know, so some of the most loved comments are, thanks, you're doing a great job. It's pretty funny.
That is funny. Well, considering
course,
they took the jobs,
you know,
away in the first place, you know, they don't get blamed
right,
for taking them away.
20% of the accounts on accounts on Twitter are bots. So, you know, those could be bots.
So how does
hey,
that
Greg.
Work? So,
hey, Derek.
Yeah, go ahead. I got a Twitter question Derek? For Derek after this, then we'll get to the report. Go ahead, Bianchi.
Yeah, Derek, are you vibing for one of the IRS jobs? You get to carry a gun.
No, man, I'm good. I'm good.
He's carried a gun. He's carried a gun for us.
Okay. I already, you know, express my Second Amendment rights and pretty much carry one everywhere I go anyway.
Yeah. So how does that – that's actually a really good question. How is that going to affect, I guess, people, individual accounts, you know? I mean, are people worried that all of a sudden – and the thing with the IRS is you can even do everything right and still be worried about the IRS. I heard some staggering amount that people actually pay about $3,000 more per year than they actually need to just – so just to make sure that they've convinced the IRS that there's no reason to audit them. Have you heard that figure?
I have, that people overpay. You know, and I always, you know, tell people, you know, we're not in the line of getting given tax advice, you know, but I tell people, you know, you don't want to let the government borrow your money all year because it's not doing anything for you. You know, you know, the government's not paying you interest on any overtax payments that you get. Yeah, they give it back to you, but you have a year of, you know, spending and interest and things that you missed out on. So don't let the government borrow your money. So it's a delicate ballet of trying to find what your tax rate is, and, you know, what you need to be bringing home. You know, obviously nobody wants the big bill at the end of the year either, you know, but at least a bill at the end of the year is better than, you know, you getting a refund of money they borrowed from you all year long, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's obviously I do my best to try to help people with that. That's, you know, we work in tandem with a tax professional and try to do our best. But, you know, I mean, the government's hiring 87,000 or potentially hiring 87,000 more IRS agents. The IRS, you know, not to be on their side for a second, is grossly understaffed. You know, I mean, I can tell you multiple instances that I've had in the past 3 to 4 years of people that can't get through to get things fixed, having to do everything by mail correspondence because they're understaffed. They don't want to answer phones. They don't want to man their offices and things like this, and being charged inordinate amount of interest, even though they had done all the things right. You know, so I agree that they do need to hire some more because I've seen some instances that this would justify additional employment. You know, I always say that people could work at a higher capacity, but don't. And when you're in a government job where they pretty much can't fire you, people are probably just going to do, you know, what they want to do. And I mean, I'm not saying that's everybody, you know what I mean? But
that's a lot of people. I've worked in government.
I've worked for the government. I'm not saying the military's like that. You know, the military, the way it's structured, you know, if you have those people, it's kind of easy to motivate them either physically or by counseling or by taking their time away or pay. Other government people, you know, I mean, I've had GS workers work for me and, you know, I mean, they just move them to another place when you have a problem with them. And, you know, I mean, it's really, really hard to fire somebody. You know, so, you know, once they're in, they're just kind of like, okay, well, I'm just going to milk this train as long as I possibly can. I'm not saying that's everybody.
No, but I work
in
government and they do. Most people are concerned with vacations and retirement and sick days and all the benefits. They don't care about the work for the most part. Look up Schedule F. Trump had something, and I reported on this a little bit in my report. I'm kind of saving this for a special day. But Trump has this thing called Schedule F, which changes the status of the federal employees so they can be fired. And they got rid of that. It was scheduled to take effect, I think, the January 21st, because they had like the 90-day comment. I mean, he did it right at the end of his first term, and it never got through, obviously. I think that's a big reason that the Brandon insurrection happened, was because Trump was going to be able to make it easy to fire federal employees. So we still need to do that. It still needs to happen.
Schedule F.
Look up Schedule F. No, I've got it right here. Hang on. I'll pull it up. I always keep
schedule
this one.
Schedule F is a job classification.
It's Brownstone Institute. That's I forgot his name, Jeffrey Tucker. Yeah. So I'll post the article here. Brownstone Institute, The Astonishing Implications of Schedule F. I'll just read the first bit. So 2 weeks before the 2020 general election, on October 21st, Donald Trump issued an executive order creating Schedule F in the accepted service. It sounds boring. Actually, it would have fundamentally changed in the best possible way the entire functioning of the administrative bureaucracy that rules this country in a way that bypasses both the legislative and judicial process that has ruined the checks and balances inherent in the U.S. Constitution. He goes on and on. Let's see if I can just one quick thing tell you exactly what it does. You know, I wasn't really prepared to do this. Schedule F employees would be fired. You know, it's employees of the federal government classified as Schedule F would have been subject to control by the elected president and other representatives. Okay. So in other words, it takes out a civil service. And it changes the classification so you become just a regular employee. Here we go. This is this is from the Washington Post. I'll post it and you can take a look at it for next week. But it would have changed everybody's classification, made it much easier to fire people. That would have been absolutely wonderful. You know, I'm trying to get Jeffrey Tucker on the show so we can talk about it. Yeah. That should be the first priority next time. All right, let's get to the report. We only got about 15 minutes. And Amber Kemper is coming back, our Constitution reporter. So I'm really glad to have her back on the show. Yeah.
Good. All righty. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Terry Park with Edward Jones bringing you the Daily Financial Market Report. Stocks ended the day mostly mixed yesterday, with U.S. equities opening higher, helped by a surprise decline in the producer price index, but later erased those gains by some of the mega-cap stocks' weakness. Today, cooler-than-expected reading follows yesterday's encouraging data on the consumer price index, which sparked hopes that the worst of the inflation may be behind us. However, the recent improvement in the trends does not change the fact that the Fed will continue to rate hikes this year. On the corporate front, Disney reported strong earnings results, adding to the signs of resiliency and profits despite the challenging macroeconomic background. Oil was up about 2% to $94 a barrel, helping the energy sector outperform. Treasury yields finish higher with the 10-year Treasury yield at 2.88%. U.S. equities closed lower today with the Dow Jones up 28 points or 0.08 to 33,337. The NASDAQ closed down 75 points or 0.58 to 12,781. And the S&P 500 closed down 3 points or 0.1 to 4207. Again, in the bond market, the 10-year Treasury yield is trading at 2.88%. In the commodity markets, price of crude oil was down $2.07 or 2.25% to $94. And the spot price of gold was down $13 or 0.69% to $18.01.10. This is Derek Park of Ever Jones, member SIPC. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Let's see if we can break down the oil price a little bit here. You said it was down $2 from, I guess, 96 was last week or what?
94 is what it – well, yeah, I guess it would be 90. 96 is what it would be on Wednesday is what it was. And then today, it's actually going down almost 2% today. So where is it at? I just looked at it earlier.
Do you know what's causing that?
I don't, actually. I mean, I haven't really kept up with it. Yeah, it's down 1.54%. It's 92.89 as of, you know, where we're at right now, 8:38 Eastern time.
Yeah, because Pianca and I were talking about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and my point was that this whole reduction in inflation, this imaginary one, is actually artificial because they're releasing so much oil from our piggy bank, you know, of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Not only are they releasing it domestically, they're releasing it internationally, which might be artificially lowering the price of oil so that their inflation numbers look better for the next election. That's what I think is going on. But go ahead.
No, I would assume that either that or, you know, I mean, there's constant, you know, I mean, you have to understand that if your constituents are unhappy, they're not going to vote the way that they want. So, yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it.
Okay. And the other thing is demand is down. You know, people, I see traffic is noticeably less, you know, in our area. You know, I don't see
Is down. Demand is down. And when you go to your Strategic Petroleum Reserve and tap out oil that was purchased, save like $50 a barrel, well, quite naturally, it's going to have a it's going to have a lowering of the price at the pump, which is superficial.
Do you know how much the lowering of the price is at the pump? Has that been measured? I hear it was only like 15, 20 cents or something like that. Derek?
I think gas stayed under $4 a gallon. So, yeah, I guess I would probably say maybe a quarter is kind of a good way to look at it.
So 25 cents out of a dollar, it's down about a dollar from where it was a month ago. So if only 25 cents is the strategic petroleum reserve, which is very hard for me to say quickly, 75 cents has to come from somewhere else. So how much of that is the reduction in the world price? Because we're not increasing the supply other than the strategic petroleum reserve. There is no other increase that I know of because the pipelines aren't increasing. The refining capacity hasn't increased. So what could account for the dollar drop? Is it all demand or 75 cents worth of demand? 25 cents worth of strategic petroleum reserve oil?
I mean, I know Saudi said they were going to increase production, but you know, that typically takes a few months before that takes hold. So, I'm not sure. I don't study enough on oil to know.
That's okay, and you don't have to. I mean, when I ask you questions, always I want to find out what you know, but there's no requirement, obviously. But the more insights we can get, I mean, that's something that I should probably look up myself because I'm trying to rationalize this through. But another thing that Pianca and I talked about is was there an environmental impact statement done before they took all the oil out of the salt dumps? Because these aren't tanks. I didn't realize that until I learned about it this year, that they actually store the oil in these geological formations, the salt domes. And the way you get oil out is you put water in, so the oil flows to the top, but the water destroys the salt dome. So not only are they diminishing our strategic petroleum reserve, they're ruining the geological formation that holds it. Has that been thought through? Has anybody noticed that or talked about that on the markets? But maybe this is a really stupid thing to do.
No, I mean, I haven't seen anything, I'm sure if you looked on the Epic Times or, you know, the Hill or something like that, you might find something, but it would be articles that would be specifically looking for something like that. You know what I mean? Like I try to go to Reuters, I go to Bloomberg, I go to Market Watch, and I go to Yahoo Finance. Now some of those are going to definitely have a political spin, I try to read through those lines.
I try and give you more interesting.
One would have to ask, how is it possible that during Trump's term, that gas practically for his entire term was less than $2 a gallon? And I can witness, took pictures, because, you know, people leave it up north. How is it, Derek?
Obviously, that if he's a little bit more open on, you know, exploration and research and stuff in the U.S., gas prices are definitely going to be lower. I mean, obviously, the Biden administration, I'm talking like first day, I mean, they came in and like canceled all the leases. Came in and increased, production costs. I mean, there was, I'd have to get the list. I've seen a list before, but, definitely, when you come out swinging like that, oil is going to get expensive.
Well, that's the supply side. That's supply side economics. That's classic, you know, Laffer curve. That's classic.
I got another question.
Conservative economics. Yeah. Then I got a question too. So go ahead real quick. And then I got,
Derek, and you said they canceled the leases. How is the federal government take possession of state land the way it has, and then you lease it out for oil exploration? Does that land not belong to the states? How did the federal government claim this land and the states let it happen?
I do not know.
We did show about it.
Greg, take it, man.
Yeah, Pianca, I want to refer you, because as soon as Pianca asked the question, I knew where I want to go with this. Pianca, you want to go back, and in fact, anybody who's interested in this, and this includes Derek too, go back to my two-hour interview with Roger Roots. Roger Roots is he's an attorney. He's a freedom-loving attorney. I think he's in South Dakota or Wyoming, one of those two states. But he was one of the attorneys that defended the Bundys. Remember when the Bundys had the property dispute with Bureau of Land Management? Well, he was one of the defense attorneys.
Absolutely.
Okay, so he's mm-hmm. so just go to the top of your broadcast page and do a keyword search and just put Roger Roots, R-O-O-T-S, and get that two-hour interview. We'll explain the entire thing. Basically, it comes down to the fact that the states don't realize that it's state land. They don't realize that the Constitution says that the feds can only own D.C. and land that's useful for arsenals, dock facilities, and basically border facilities. That's it. All the land in the states, even though the feds claimed it.
Like F troop.
Well, it's actually state land.
Remember so the TV then, series F troop?
I remember F troop.
That's their arsenal.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the point, though. The point is that this land is actually state land. You're absolutely right. So the states at any time, especially the western states, could take their land and they could do the leases themselves. In fact, I advocated that over the course of several shows. So that's a different thing. But I got a Derek question. If the they're selling oil now from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or are they giving it away? Because if they're selling it at a higher price than it was bought, which means there's a profit margin in there. So I'm wondering, are they paying taxes on? Is the government paying taxes on the profit that they're making from selling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve now at a higher price than when Trump bought the oil? I mean, how does that work?
Man, you got the good ones today, man.
I'm just making these up.
It briefs well. I mean, you know, what you're saying holds water. I mean, yeah. Like I just, man, I'd have to go, you know, you're asking very specific things that I don't look for.
That's okay. You know, well, next week, you know me, I always have homework.
Yeah.
Well, but think about
not
it.
That they don't exist. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's okay. But I'll make a little notes for myself for next week. But this oil is making a profit. If they're selling it now, they're obviously selling it at a higher price than Trump bought it. So where's the profit? Where's the extra going? Follow the money,
man. I don't know. Like,
well, let me ask you another one. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
They always say follow the money. You know.
Yeah. Well. Is it going to the Democrat Party? Is it a slush fund? Is the Brandon insurrection using it for nefarious purposes? I don't know. But if they're giving it away, they're stupid. That should be illegal. And if they're selling it, then they're making a profit.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, not only that, and then, you know, in the new Inflation Reduction Act, you know, they we have tax increases pretty much, you know, about 2% across the board.
Well, how's that going to affect? How what kind of tax increases are we talking about? Who's going to get hit with those? The latest from the Inflation Production Act, as Rand Paul calls it, or Ron Paul, one of the Pauls.
Hold on a second. I have a chart I posted.
Oh, okay.
That had all.
Please
of the,
feel free.
I've already posted it.
Well, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. So,
help me
so
out.
So one of the biggest tax increases is people that make less than $10,000. It's 3.1%. And people that make 20 to 30 is 1%. Now, the people that make 30 to 100,000 is average of 0.8, 0.9. And then over 100,000 goes from 1.1 to 2%. Is the bracket. So the people with the biggest tax raise are the people that make less than 10,000.
Well, people that make less than 10,000, the standard deduction is larger than that. There's no income tax. Have they changed the standard deduction? What have they done?
It says on the posted, this is the distributional effects of Title I Committee on Finance. I mean, so this is from the bill, H.R. 5376, Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. It shows what the taxes are present law. And then what they are, you know, with the increase, what it's going to bring in.
So what's the source then? Because if people aren't paying taxes, people that make $10,000 a year don't pay taxes. In fact, there's a lot of welfare they're getting. You've got food stamps, you've got housing, you've got, if you're only making $10,000 a year.
If they still have income, there's still taxation. Yeah.
Well, but what I'm saying is, but if you've got a what's the standard deduction this year? 13, 14,000? What is it?
I don't know. I'll look.
Okay, so it was 12,000 in 2019 because that's when I wrote my bill that said there should be no withholding, you know, because getting to your point earlier of the free loan to the government, there should be no withholding of any income for income tax purposes until you've earned your standard deduction, because that money's coming back to you in a year anyway. So why should you, you know, have to give it to the government? So my question is, if the income tax standard deduction is probably somewhere between $13,000 and $14,000 this year. Let's just say $13,000, went up $1,000.
No, under Trump, it's $24,000 for couples.
Okay, I'm not talking couples. I'm just talking individuals. Okay, but because the couples just means it doubles.
Then it would be $12,000.
It's still an individual rate. So if they're taxing, go ahead, Derek.
$12,000 individual.
Yeah, it's got to be $12,000 if that's the number. I mean, so.
Well, that's what it was in 2019, but it's indexed to inflation, so it's going to be bigger this year. For 2022,
I don't know how that works.
Okay, well, I mean, let's just say, for example, say it is $12,000 because it's not going to be less than
$12,950.
Say that again.
$12,950 for 2022.
Okay, so that's $13,000 basically. So you got $13,000 standard deduction, okay, and then you've got, but they're taxing people who make less than $10,000 more. That to me seems a contradiction. You can't tax people more at a lower income level than the standard deduction, which takes all that income off being taxable anyway.
Mm-hmm.
This is my confusion.
Yeah.
Unless there's another tax that's not income, unless they're increasing some other tax, like maybe sales tax. Is there a federal sales tax or a federal gas tax?
Oh,
I mean, how are they taxing?
There is a federal.
So my question is, which tax are they increasing to affect people that make less than $10,000?
I haven't dug that deep into it, Greg, but I mean, I'll look. You know, I mean, I don't know where specifically they're doing it. I just know it's wrapped in the bill.
Interesting. Okay, so basically, if you're up for it and if you want to, you know, you have a chance because I know you're busy. But if you listen to our report today and just write down like those three or four questions, whatever interests you to present next week. That would be fabulous because there's a lot there. Yeah. Yeah.
Let me do this.
You know, another thing.
I got Amber on the line. I want to bring her on just a second here. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, boy, Amber's back. Great. You know, another thing, too, Derek, is that on the forums for 2022, the question is going to be asked about cryptocurrency.
Yes.
Now, here's the thing. There's no way for people to know, any agency to know what you have in cryptocurrency because of how the addresses and so forth are stored. And you never give your address out because it's dangerous. Somebody gets your addresses, then they have access just like giving out your bank account.
It's not realized. Address. Yeah. Let's make this quick. I want to take this next week.
Different. See, if they got your bank account, it's one thing. But if they got it when it's coming to the blockchain, they can go in and take your money out. I mean, it has happened. So what is the purpose going on here?
Yeah, well, the government definitely wants to get their hands on that because that's a lot of money to be taxed. But how they're going to get that figured out, I don't know, but I'll look into it.
You know, and Derek, let's pick a week and do a crypto briefing because I know nothing about it. And that would be really helpful to take. It doesn't have to be next week, but just whenever you feel like it, let's do a really good analysis of cryptocurrency. We've got Amber and see if Amber has a financial question. She's not even paying taxes yet. So we're going to get to you, Amber. But Amber, you're following Derek's financial report, just either based on what we're listening to or anything else. Do you have any financial questions that you might want to try at this time?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Well, you're a little quiet. We need to get a little closer to your phone, or I'd like to get you a microphone at some point so that you just speak up a little bit.
Yeah.
That's better. Yeah, much better. Okay. Questions, or you want to save it for another time? Okay. Well,
I don't have any at the moment.
Okay. Well, in that case, hang on. Derek, why don't you give your information one more time? And, of course, you're welcome to stick around. Amber's one of our new superstars here, so I'm really glad to have her back from the Patriot Academy. Derek, go ahead.
Well, good. All right. Well, thanks, Greg. This is Derek Parker of Ever Jones. You can get me at 850-995-0082. And I'm not going to be able to stick around. I gotta take my daughter somewhere today.
Okay. Well, have fun then. Say hi for me.
All right. Take care.
There you go. Thank you very much. So that's Derek with our financial report. I don't have a theme for Amber yet, so let's give her a round of applause. Here we go. And I'm working on your theme. I got the music picked out, so we're going to I'll have something for you in a little bit. But I think your report's about to expand. We've been talking off the air a little bit, and Amber's doing some pretty incredible things. Of course, I want to hear all about them. So briefly describe you again in a couple of lines, and then let's get into this whole wonderful experience with the Patriot Academy. I am very curious about that, as you know. So welcome back. Glad to have you. And let's hear your story, and then let's talk Patriot Academy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back. My name is Amber Kemper. I am now 18 years old.
Oh, congratulations. You're an adult. We can pick on you now.
I graduated high school in May, so I'll be attending Pensacola Christian College in Florida for a major in elementary education. So,
Interesting. What's that place called again?
Pensacola Christian College.
Oh, we're going to be neighbors. I'm in Milton. You're like across the water.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to get all of our local folks together. So you're in this area. Derek Park's in this area. Josie's in this area. Our Wild Women of Wellness, Chancey, Lindsay, and Paige, they're in this area too. We got some other folks that are around here as well. So we're all going to meet someday. This is going to be great. Great to have you in the area. And you can tell us about the college and maybe report from there. And, this is going to be fabulous. Hey, I'm thrilled. It's a private college, I assume?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me ask you a quick question about education degrees, because if you went to a traditionally state-controlled, government-controlled, liberal college to get an education degree, you're going to be propagandized. You're going to be told, white people suck, critical race theory is the way to go.
Right.
You know, this country's based on slavery. You're going to have to learn a whole bunch of crap that's not going to fit with your knowledge and your political beliefs.
Yeah, that's what I like about Pensacola Christian College. Because they don't take federal funds, so they do not, under any circumstances, have to teach critical race theory or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a great experience here because, as you make presentations here, you can definitely talk to the kids. Elementary schools, we're talking kindergarten through sixth grade?
Through sixth, yeah.
Okay. So why teach? What's the attraction to that? I'm curious. I mean, it makes sense for you. It makes perfect sense, actually. But I'm just curious, yeah.
I've always wanted to be a teacher, so it just kind of made sense. But now with me being so involved in politics, everybody's like, are you sure you don't want to be a major in poli-science? Don't want to be a teacher, so.
You don't have to. The people think that you have to work at your career, and that's it. Look at me. I mean, I play guitar. I'm trying to form another rock band. I do action radio. I used to be a competitive shooter, and so politics, I do it as a profession because it makes sense for my radio show. But even, before I started action radio, I was still writing articles. I was doing all kinds of things in politics. I used to call talk shows and I was an active participant. Mm-hmm. There's no reason in the world why you can't be, the world's greatest elementary school teacher and still have a big interest in politics. But you're going to have to work at a place where that's not going to be a conflict. So you're looking at private schools for teaching, I'm assuming.
Yeah. That's the best option right now with the way the school is.
Well, let's get Pensacola Christian College on the show. So once you get there and you're comfortable, let's have them come on the show and they can tell their story and you can interview them and, go from there. How's that sound?
Yeah, that would be so much fun.
All right. So tell me about Patriot Academy. I read your entire brief on it, but I want to hear your story. Highlights, what is it? And, of course, I want to get them on the show, too. I think this is an incredible thing, this experience that you just had. So tell me the story.
Yeah, so Patriot Academy is basically mock legislation. So everybody, there were 120 students. Everybody writes their own bill, and then they come to the Texas Capitol or wherever it's being held. The Texas Capitol is the biggest one.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come, and we have different sessions with different speakers. And then we go and break apart into committee sessions. In those committee sessions, we debate and ask those bills like they would in a real committee.
Mm-hmm.
So we present them and ask questions on them and pass them as if we were a real committee. From there, we go to the House floor and we do the same thing as if we were actually on the House floor. So we debate and pass bills on the actual House floor of the Texas Capitol. It is a lot of fun. And actually, it's one of the it's the best mock legislation in the nation. In fact, multiple people that are new to politics will come and just watch, just to get an idea of what the process is. It's really fun and really interesting.
It sounds like it. I wanted some specifics on the committees and the, particularly the guests. But did you present the bill that you wrote, you know, requiring people running for office and elected officials to take the citizenship, the immigration citizenship test? Was that one of your bills?
I did present that one. Yeah, so I got three bills. That one was we only had time for one of them, so that one was the one I presented.
Okay.
But it ended up dying in committee. It was a 6-6 vote. It ended up dying in committee because they didn't like that it was requiring all elected officials, including school board and city council members.
Hmm.
They said it should be just those in legislation. I beg to differ. And that was something I was not willing to budge on. So for a committee substitute, I was not willing to make it just those in legislation.
So they had an amendment process. You could have accepted the amendment like a friendly amendment and modified your bill, and it might have been accepted, but you chose to – what was your rationale for that? I'm curious.
So a lot of people, when they first get into politics, start on the lower level, and then they work their way up. So if we can knock out the, quote-unquote, bad guys at the lower level, then we don't have that issue up at the top.
Okay. But what I'm saying is that in the committee voted down your bill, which happens. I mean, most bills do not pass.
Right.
Of the thousands that get submitted, only maybe, fortunately, only a couple of hundred or less. I don't know what the ratio is. But most bills do not pass. That's why the system works. It's designed to, because a lot of bills are really stupid. You know, mm-hmm. National Donut Day or whatever people are filing. But you had a good bill. But what's interesting that you were not willing to compromise on it. In other words, you'd rather have good legislation, as far as you're concerned, than partial legislation. So you'd rather go for the full victory as opposed to getting something through. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I'm curious your rationale for that, and then I'll talk about something that came to me in the adult full legislatures, because this is a tactic that people use.
So like I said, I think it's important that everybody takes the citizenship test, no matter where you're located in the ranks, because you have some sort of power and you're representing somebody. Under no circumstances should you be representing them wrong and against the Constitution. So I thought it was very important that everybody take it. No matter what.
No, I agree with you. And I'll tell you why that's a tactic is because what happens is bills get watered down. And if you accept mm-hmm. the watered down version, then when you come back with amendments to it later, they say, well, we passed your bill. What's your problem? So that's a way that's a tactic you'll see in politics as a way to stop, you know, good legislation. They water it down. And then if you don't take the watered down version, they say, well, we just changed your bill a little bit. I mean, it's still good. It's still your bill. Why don't you take it? So it doesn't matter what you do, they're going to find a way to affect your bill. So I admire you for standing strong on that. I think that's the principal position. That's the right one to take. Jim Dykes, who's our Second Amendment reporter, brought up something. He does a lot of the court cases and very much involved in the Constitution. And what he was saying was that it wouldn't work in Congress because the Constitution spells out very specific requirements, which cannot be, you know, you can't cut into them, but you can't add extra ones onto it either. And he makes a really good point. So have you considered that the Constitution says you have to be from the state a certain age, and that's pretty much it. You can't put an immigration test onto these folks, you know, as a law, because the Constitution will say you're exceeding the authority of the Constitution for what people – the eligibility requirements.
Right. So that was brought up in committee as well.
Okay.
The thing is, it's not preventing them from running or from getting an office. It's just – a form of guidelines for the voters. Like if they see that, oh, so-and-so didn't even take the test, why didn't he take the test? Or so-and-so took the test and got a 20%, do we really want him to represent us?
I've forgotten this in the bill. So it's not mandated, so you're not actually requiring people to do this. You're just suggesting it's a really good idea. So where in law did we put this? I've forgotten. You'd have to, get me back informed again. Where was it going to go? State level, which you can do in the state level.
I could do state, but I think it was originally federal.
Okay. So, so how do you resolve the constitutional question then?
About it the elected officials.
Well, yeah, I forgot where it is. It's in one of the articles. It's probably Article 1. I mean, I'm not as well versed in this particular part of the Constitution, but there's certain requirements for running for Congress, and it doesn't include a citizenship or a knowledge test.
Right.
I'm sort of flipping through my Constitution. We can pick this up another time. I'm just curious, though, because it's a legitimate question. Of course, I think it should be required, but I don't want to, you know, being a constitutionalist and actually going by the letter of the Constitution, I don't want to exceed the authority. Okay, so that's something to work on in the bill. We got to resolve that question too. Okay, did you find an advantage having been a citizen legislator already having, you know, worked a bill through Action Radio? In the course of your experience with Patriot Academy?
A little bit, yeah. It definitely helped to, answer the questions that people had in regards to the bill.
Okay.
So that was definitely nice, yeah.
Yeah. What were the other two that you brought? I'm curious.
So the second one, this one was probably my least favorite, but it was basically banning razors from prison. Because it's ridiculous that we allow razors in prison when they are the most compensated item in federal prison. It's ridiculous. And then the second one, this one's really good too, is basically for the state of Texas creating a gas tax for electric vehicles or road tax for electric vehicles.
Oh, I love this one. I want you to write this one for us. Or if you've already written it, this is good. I actually proposed a hazmat fee for electric vehicles of either $20,000 or $25,000, you know, to deal with the batteries. So instead of having a tax subsidy, that we have an electric vehicle tax, a hazmat tax, or a battery disposal fee tax added to the cost of every electric vehicle. So tell me about your thing. Maybe we can merge these two ideas. What was yours?
They're not as green as they say they are.
Oh, not even close. They're actually worse for the environment than gas-powered cars. Plus the fact you lose 10% of your electricity, you know, generally from power plant to end user. People forget that. Transmission lines leak. Pipelines, unless there's a problem, don't. You know, so you get 100% of your power. Yeah. So what was in your provision? What were you going to do with it? I'm curious.
So, you know, when you pay for gas, depending on the state and the state of Texas, about 20% of it goes to the gas tax or the road tax for maintenance of roads. So what I was proposing is that upon registration of the electric vehicle, they would pay a fine for the gas tax. So it's different for every state. So for Texas, it was, I want to say, $150 per year.
And that would be that's an electricity tax or road tax?
That would be a road tax, yeah.
Okay. Well, how much does the average person pay in federal tax, you know, over the course of regular driving? Did you have that information?
One sec. Let me pull it up. I did do some math.
Maybe as much as 20 cents a gallon or more.
Because you want it comparable. You know, you want to have a comparable tax, so there's no incentive to. In other words, if the electric road tax is less than the gas road tax, then it's not good. We want to equalize them based on an equivalent. So, you know, per kilowatt hours, you know, charged for an electric vehicle. I don't know how you account for that because they just plug it in their house. I'm not sure how that would go, but we might have to have a separate smart meter for charging an electric car. Well, this is getting really interesting now. I love this tangent.
It may want to be more. It may want to be more, Amber, because now you're putting people out of work. They may need to be retrained, and that burden should not fall on them. Tax the electric cars.
You might tax at the generation point, too, because they're using coal, oil, and natural gas. You know, they're using, quote, fossil fuels. You know, they're using petroleum fuel to generate the electricity in the first place. So you might want to, especially since they're government entities. You know, all right, so what do you find? I'm curious. What's the how many gallons are people using a year or whatever?
For Texas, let's see. It's approximately $64 for a $16 gallon. Wait, hold on. Let me restart.
Wait a minute.
$64 for a full 16 gallons currently.
So what's the price? What's the federal gas tax per gallon? Let's figure that.
20 cents per gallon.
So 20 cents a gallon. The average car is 16 gallons. So that's
right.
So that's 20.
$4 per gallon.
So you need to find an equivalent of $4 per tank full. Right? If it's 16.
Right. No.
Okay, so yeah. That should be less than that.
Well, right now it is, yeah.
20 cents is
but
1/5
okay.
of a gallon. So 1/5 of the price of gas for the gas tax. Yeah, anyway, whatever it is, yeah, we don't want to do the math right now. But if you can find an equivalency, you know, per kilowatt hour, however they measure, this is going to get a little technical, but you want to make it equivalent to the federal gas tax or the state gas tax, because states have gas tax too. So whatever the state gas tax is of Florida, you want to have an equivalent, you know, and then you have to probably get into how much charge, you know, gets you, or how much you get, so many miles per tank full or so many miles per gallon. So if you get a car averaging 30 miles per gallon, well, how much electricity does the average electric car take to go 30 miles? And then you want to have an equivalent 20 cent tax per mile or per, you know, whatever it is to equal the gas tax. And math is not my specialty. So, you know, you probably know more about it than I do, but you see what I'm getting to?
Right. Yeah. Just fine.
I love this bill. I love this. And then you can incorporate a hazmat fee, you know, see if you can
mm-hmm.
figure what to take in the cost of disposal. And I'll have you back on we're going to spend an hour just on this. We'll probably spend a lot of time on this bill. This is something we can definitely send out. You know, this could be campaign material, especially for 2024. But this is something that you could get to the governor of Texas. You could get to, you know, some of your state representatives, anybody you know. And that one, you know, again, we'll get to Patriot Academy in a minute. But let's think about that bill and see what you can come up with, incorporating both a hazmat fee and a charge fee to find a way to charge electricity going to electric cars equivalent to the gas tax.
Yeah.
Yeah, you may have to listen to this again on the podcast and go, what are we all talking about? And just take notes. This is what I do. This is how I get stuff like that. But this is fabulous. I love this idea. All right, so Patriot Academy, what is it? How did it come about?
Yeah, so how did I come about it?
No, how did it come about? And what you know about Patriot Academy? And then you can tell us how you got involved with it. That'd be interesting too.
Yeah, so the person that found it, Rick Green, he used to be in the Texas legislature. And he was upset because bills were getting passed that he didn't like. And they just kept getting passed and passed and passed. And so he was irritated. And so he called his dad and was talking to his dad about it. And his dad said, well, why don't you just do what Bill Clinton did? And Rick Green was like, well, what did Bill Clinton do? Why would I do something that Bill Clinton did? And,
that's a good question, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he said, well, Bill Clinton had a conference for the next generation teaching them mock legislation and was putting liberal values into them. He said, why don't you do that for conservatives? And so he started it. He did it. That was like 20 years ago, I want to say. So he's been doing it every year since.
Why don't we hear about this on the news? This is fabulous. Why isn't this more widely reported?
I know. I don't know.
Huh. Hey, Pianki, do you remember when Trump had the Black Leadership Conference? He brought a bunch of black teenagers to the White House? Basically the same kind of idea?
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of that conference? Because that's something that maybe Patriot Academy could team up with, especially when Trump comes back.
You know, I think what it was, it was done around the time of Black History Month. He brought in a lot of conservative auditorium of black conservative students that was highly supported of him. And they got ridiculed by some of your, what we call gatekeepers, like Al Sharpton, criticized them for doing that. And, you know, Amber made mention about the efforts to create more liberals in your school. Well, the same thing should be done, like you was recommended that you do to get conservative values and ideology. I think too much emphasis sometimes is put on the politician rather than the electorate. because it's dumb electorate, uninformed electorate, just vote people because of name recognition or whatever strikes their fancy. And once that politician gets in there, they are subjected to special interests and not the people that voted for them. Because the people that voted for them did not give them any marching orders.
Amber, what do you think? Do you know the group I'm talking about or that Trump had, Black Leadership Conference, that you know?
I'm not sure I've heard of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Chris, I want to talk to Trump anyway at some point just because I want to get him all our ideas. So here's my question for you now. Here's my big question. A, I want to talk to Rick Green on the show. So if you can,
yeah.
I don't know how much contact you have with him, but if he's amenable to coming on, I want to hear all about this. Now, here's my big plan that I'm just kind of like formulating in my head as we're talking here. If all these students, these conservative, these wonderful students, you know, are out there, you know, with all this great knowledge in their head, why not continue on as citizen legislators taking bills that they want from Action Radio and continuing the work that they learned how to do at Patriot Academy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think?
I agree.
Yeah, and you can lead that because you're in both places. You're at Patriot Academy and you're here. So you'd be the perfect person to talk to Rick about. Let's get some kind of a distribution network so all these student lobbyists, anybody who's taken Patriot Academy in the last, I don't know, 10, 20 years, you know, if they're still on the mailing list, say, here's some citizen, well, you can pick it because you'd be working with Rick directly on this, I'm sure. You know, pick some citizen legislation that you particularly like and say, would you be interested in advocating these bills at the state level and at the federal level? I'm looking for lobbyists around the country. I'm serious about this. I'm looking for lobbyists in every state capital. I'm looking for lobbyists in D.C. and people who have been to Patriot Academy, you know, can do this in their spare time. They can call, they can write, they can do everything. They don't have to be there. But if you have some Patriot Academy graduates living in Virginia and Maryland, just outside D.C., I'll make them lobbyists, you know, and I'll have them reporting on the show direct from D.C. This is where I want, this would be the perfect group to get our lobbyists from.
Mm-hmm.
I am so glad you called and filed that bill and joined our show. I can't tell you. This is we're going to break some all kinds of new ground here. Do you think Rick would like that idea?
Oh, I'm sure he would.
Is he still a legislator or is he running Patriot Academy now?
He's not. He was beat by somebody. I don't remember who.
Some rhino. Do you know what we call rhinos now?
What?
Transgender Democrats.
You're not wrong.
You can use that, by the way. Any of our expressions you're free to use. Like gelding old party. You know, that's what the GOP is, the gelding old party. I hesitate to ask this, but do you know what a gelding is?
I do not.
Look it up sometime. We'll tell you later. You'll be amused at the definition. All right. So you had some amazing guests. Who were they? Who did you get to talk to? What did you learn? You know, tell me about some of the highlights of that.
There were a ton of great people. We had a lot from the Daily Wire. So we had Matt Walsh, Michael Knowles, some of those big name people. We also had Ali Bastecki.
Who's that? Is it Daily Wire?
No, so she's a conservative influencer. She's mainly on social media. I'm not too familiar with her. I know she's written a couple books, but she
what's
was...
What's a conservative influencer? I mean, I think big tech has censored all the conservatives on social media. How does she do her job?
She's on social media, you know, of course getting censored like everybody else, but... She's the conservative one. But yeah,
what was her name again?
She's really,
what's her name?
Ali Bastecki.
A-L-I? How do you spell her name?
A-L-L-I-E, Best, and then S-T-U-C-K-E-Y.
Oh, Ali Beth Stucky.
Yeah, Beth Stucky, yeah.
Okay. You said it so fast, I don't know where the first name ended and the last name began.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No, no surprise. Radio. I mean, this is one of those little assumptions. I'm stuck. And she's a conservative influencer. All right, cause needless to say, I want her to influence on some of our conservative legislation. Did you get a chance? We're just sidelining a little bit here. We're going to get back to guests. But we have two bills that I think would be amazingly important to younger folks and to conservatives and to Patriot Academy. One is our constitutional amendment to take away the power of Congress to borrow money. Did you ever get a chance to take a look at that?
Man, I pulled it up this morning, and I didn't get a chance to actually read through it.
It's very short. But this is something that Ali Beth Stuckey might love. I'm writing a conservative influencer, and I'm spelling it badly because I'm talking at the same time. I didn't even know there was such a thing. Okay, and the other one is you know how the IRS has now got 87,000, you know, armed Gestapo agents.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was thinking, well, the most recent bill is the I forgot what I changed the title of it, but basically it's a federal disarmament for those bureaucrats that aren't constitutionally charged with the only three federal crimes there are, which is treason, piracy, and counterfeiting. So basically it disarms the feds, all the unconstitutionally armed ones, and turns those weapons and ammunition over to the civilian marksmanship program for distribution back to American taxpayers.
I did have a question on that one. Are they
not
allowed, they're not allowed to have guns on while they're on the job? Is that what it is?
Well, then, no, the departments would actually turn those guns in. So they'd be forced to turn them in. So, yeah, they wouldn't have them at all. Now, if a federal employee is in a jurisdiction where they're legally allowed to carry as a private citizen, they can do whatever they want. Could they carry on the job their private guns? Probably. You know, they're still responsible for their use.
How come they don't apply to teachers in schools?
That's a good question. I don't know how they do that. Depends on the job. I haven't actually thought that through. That's a really good point. That's something we may want to consider and add to the bill. I don't think I want to be in the business of restricting anybody with this bill. This bill specifically concerns, you know, the armed SWAT teams and like the Department of Education, the NOAA folks, you know, the IRS agents who can do most of what they do on computer. I mean, they can seize your assets, they can seize your bank accounts, they can seize everything by computer. Why do they need anybody to be armed? Quite honestly.
Well, another thing Amber should recognize is that for instance, when they say that when Biden got elected, he removed leases for exploration of oil and gas on lands. Well, Amber, the federal government shouldn't own land in states anyway. Those are states' land, and that's something that people don't even conceive. Another point. FBI and other agents should not come into, for instance, the state of Texas and go to Sarasota and knock on somebody's address and ask him questions. They should check in with the local authorities and the sheriff. And guess what? They should be made to leave their guns at their sheriff office. If not, the cry that we have too many guns on the streets now. Listen, if you're accompanied by a sheriff department, then they the ones have the guns that they're to protect the citizens of their community, not the FBI.
Yeah,
we've talked about that too. That's an excellent idea. I've thought that as well, that all enforcement should be local, that the Fed should not have guns at all. And that includes especially the FBI. Mm-hmm. Amber, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree, especially with what happened at Trump's place recently.
Was that talked about at the conference or had it not happened yet?
It hadn't happened yet.
Okay. Yeah, but you would have talked about it if it had. Well, what's the feeling on that? Your feeling and anybody else you've talked to about it?
Completely ridiculous. Under no circumstances should they have done that.
Do you think that's going to change a lot of votes in Texas or among your friends? Or are your friends pretty conservative to begin with? The fact that Trump got raided. Trump got raided, excuse me. Has that emboldened anybody? Because younger folks traditionally aren't as politically involved. I'm guessing your friends are more involved simply because you're more involved. But I'm just wondering, people right. you talk to, you know, your peers, what are they saying?
All of us are more, like, if Trump was the only option, it was Trump versus Biden, we would vote for Trump. But I think a majority of us are like, he should probably not run again. Maybe let somebody like DeSantis run.
That's interesting.
Trump,
why is that?
Trump,
I'm curious.
Trump has so much hate on him that we would get nowhere with him being president again. While I think he would do the job better than most, there's just too much hate on him. Let somebody like DeSantis, who is also hated but hasn't had the opportunity to be president, let him try that.
Yeah, but what is it that they're hating? Is they hating him as a human being, or are they hating his policies? His policies are excellent. Matter of fact, DeSantis have exercised some of the policies that Trump do. So the thing is this, is that you vote for a politician because of the policies that you have instilled in them with your ideas and wants and desires as a electorate. Don't let them run half-shot the way we see so many.
I agree, but unfortunately, a lot of the nation does not see that way.
Yeah, see, my philosophy is lead. Don't be a victim of the followers. And so to me, I think it would be a tremendous waste not to have Trump in there, because you tell the left that they've won, that if they can demonize somebody who had incredible policies mm-hmm. that people loved, you know, then they win. And I think Trump should run, you know, I think he should run anyway. I think he's going to run. I think he's going to win. I think he's going to do a fabulous job because he knows all the mistakes he made the first term. He's had 4 years to think about all the things that went wrong his first term. He's going to come back like nobody else. Like the DeSantis would have to take 4 years to learn what Trump already knows. So I think it'd be a tremendous waste of time and a disservice to all of us patriots, America firsters, to have Trump not win and not run in 2024. DeSantis can run in 2028. I mean, that would be actually better, because then we'd have a real continuity, because then he'd have another 4 years of Trump policies that DeSantis could pick up on. I mean, he'll change some things. Everybody does. But at least he'd have that Trump background, and you'd have that solid thing. Now, the press is going to go after him. The press is going to hate him. But it might be different this time, simply because, you know, he can say, well, you tried that the last time, and you lied. And everybody knows they lied. So he might be a lot better at it. He might pick a better staff. And I was just talking about with Derek, the Schedule F. If he gets that through, then all those federal employees will be on a firing basis. You know, there won't be civil service. They'll be subject to, you know, normal corporate rules, which are you screw up, you get fired. So I see a tremendous advantage for Trump. So I'm going to disagree with you on that DeSantis should run this time. I think he should go next time in 2028.
That is a good point.
Okay. Yeah. Well, tell me more guests or anything else you want to talk about. We got about 24 minutes, but we actually can run over, but you know, I don't want to do that unless you have some extra time. But let's get to anything more on the Patriot Academy that you wanted to talk about, guests, policies, things, quirky things that happened, things you learned. I'm just curious.
There was something that was interesting. So at Patriot Academy, they make us carry around a golf ball in our hand the entire time, which is really interesting. They say that our golf ball represents our character. So we want to have our character on display at all times, and we don't want to let go of it.
You're carrying a golf ball. Oh, this is hysterical. Yeah, I remember reading something about that. Is it marked? Does it have your name on it? Does it have symbols on it? Do you decorate your golf ball?
No, it just says Patriot Academy on it. So it's nothing. It's not like a special golf ball unless you're in the cabinet. The cabinet had special golf balls.
What if you drop your golf ball? And you can't put it in your pocket, right? You got to hang on to it the whole time, right?
So if you drop your golf ball, then it gets taken from you, and you have to retrieve it by saying a character quote in front of everybody. and then if you drop it your third time, and if you lose it your third time, you have to sing the silly songs with Larry, Oh, Where's My Hairbrush? But it's, Oh, Where's My Golf Ball? So on that third time, we had lots of people singing.
Oh, see, now, did you drop your golf ball at any point?
I did not drop my golf ball.
I'm impressed. Yeah, see, this is Action Radio. You've learned focus. You know, I want to channel like the Karate Kid at this point. Amber, you've achieved focus is a good thing. Karate good, focus good. Make good legislator, make good teacher, make good citizen advocate. A very good thing. You familiar with the Karate Kid?
Yes.
Okay, good. Just want to check. I hate doing a reference to something and nobody knows. You know, it's like if I did Yoda, you know, and you didn't know who Yoda was. Force is strong with you with this young Padawan. Going to be Jedi one day. Sorry. It's a hobby.
Pretty good.
Oh, thank you. I have fun with my impression. It probably sounds good on radio because, you know, you don't see my face. You know, you're thinking Yoda and you're thinking, you know, Mr. Miyagi. So that definitely helps the overall. So now this is interesting. Now, did they explain the focus point about this? Did you get the hidden lesson, like painting fence so that you can win the karate competition at the end of the movie? You know, so what did they say?
They told us when we got our golf balls that it represents our character. Our character is constantly on display, and that we should always keep it in check. So always have it and know where it is, where it's at. Somebody asked if we were allowed to take another person's golf ball, and they said no, because you don't want to be accused of taking somebody's character.
So
they'd be like character appropriation?
Yeah. It was a really good
show. Go ahead. Well, I'm just thinking all these jokes come to mind. Like if you destroy somebody else's golf ball, would that be a character assassination?
Good question.
These are things we ponder here. There are no bonds at Action Radio. Yeah. What's that? I'm sorry?
Yeah. You should be holding on to your golf ball, though, so it shouldn't be destroyed. So it can't.
You should hang
on
to your character. You're absolutely right. Don't let them assassinate your character. Well,
yeah.
Let's get back to serious stuff here for a second. This is funny, though. You got to keep your humor in politics. I don't know if they have a humor in politics workshop, but I find people get very upset. And this is just, you know, general knowledge for you, that if you don't keep your humor, if you don't take the victories when you can, you're going to go crazy because there's always going to be people against you, things against you. Did they talk about that at all, about keeping your humor in perspective in this crazy business?
I think they did, actually, but that is a good point.
Yeah, bring that up with where's his name? I wrote it down here somewhere. Rick Green. Yeah, there we go.
Rick Green,
I really want to get him on the show. Did you talk to him? Do you know him personally that you might be able to get him on the show?
I have talked to him a little bit, and I did tell him about the show. I'll have to email him and see.
What do you think? What do you think of our little citizen legislature?
He thought it was really cool. He, and a couple of his friends actually do constitution reports on, is it a daily basis?
Ooh, did you tell him that you do a constitution report?
Yeah. So I told him I was on the podcast, and he was like, oh, what do you talk about? And I was like, the constitution. And he got really excited. So I'm sure he would love to be on one day.
Why don't you send him some podcasts of you? I mean, we're live now. You know. Oh, just to let you know, too, don't get overwhelmed, but the nations that are listening to us are growing. You know, I was just checking the internet. I love checking the international map. Latvia is back. Uganda just came back, I think, this week. Chile is back after a long absence. And we have some new countries, too. And I forgot which one. Sri Lanka. We have listeners in Sri Lanka, too. Probably not many, you know, but the big nations that are increasing are Canada, Australia, and England. So the English-speaking world, you know, the new fascist world is catching up with what we're doing here. And they're liking our bills. Well, we wrote a Bill of Rights for Australia. So that's a big deal. And it was on TNT Radio. I've been interviewed a bunch of times this last week, and TNT Radio had me on three times. And one of the hosts is married to an Australian. He's out of Los Angeles. The company's Australian. So now they're looking into our Australian Bill of Individual Rights. That's something you might want to take a look at and send over to Rick Green as well, because there's some things in there that we could use in our own constitution.
Yeah. Interesting. I never even thought about looking at other countries' legislation, but that is a good.
Well, I want to learn about it because and other countries have parliamentary systems. So we're dealing with parliamentary. We're dealing with – we actually have listeners in Iran. I don't know how much headway we're going to make with the mullahs. Probably not much, you know, but we have listeners in Indonesia, and that's a Muslim country. Muslim countries I'm really curious about. But the first place is to learn about parliamentary procedure. How can we turn citizen advocates into lobbyists in, say, Canada, Australia, and England, all of which are under a similar parliamentary system? That's going to be something new for us to learn. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on that, or do you want to take a few minutes on any of the constitution issues you want to delve into?
Yeah, we can.
What would you like to do?
There was another speaker I found really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah, so her name's Jackie Schlegel. She's the founder of Texans for Vaccine Freedom. She talked a lot about the vaccines. There were a couple of graphs that she showed that were like children's vaccines in like the 1900s versus now. And there are about 50 more vaccines than there were back then. It's insane. And you know, they're giving you 6, 7, 8 shots at a time that have never been tested together. So those 8 shots that you're getting have never been tested at the same time on the same individual. Could ruin your...
Well, we think this is where a lot of autism and other problems come from. I mean, Bobby Kennedy's big on this, and he talks about when he was a kid, which is a little bit before I was a kid, you know, they didn't have this autism rate. They didn't have this diabetes rate. They didn't have ADHD. They didn't have any of the problems they have now. I think a lot of it comes from vaccines. You don't have to answer this question, but I'm just wondering if you were as vaccinated as other folks. And again, feel free to decline to answer that.
Beg
pardon?
Not.
Okay.
I'm not vaccinated, no.
Yeah. See, that makes a difference. My daughter was not. In fact, they actually gave her one that I specifically said not to. I said, that's it. We're done. Mm-hmm. And I picked a couple of them. And this is back in the 90s, you know, when my daughter was a kid. And back then we thought that maybe a couple of the traditional vaccines, MMR, DPT, might be okay, but nothing else. Because those have been proven for decades. So she got two. Mm-hmm. And then they threw, I think, a hepatitis B. I said, how dare you? I specifically ordered you not to do that. You gave my kids something and I specifically told you not to. We left right then and there. We left, I think it was Kaiser. Mm-hmm. We just walked. I said, that's it. I want the papers. We're out of here. I'm not talking to you people anymore. You know, I said, I don't know if I'm going to sue you or not. We'll see how this goes. But I said, but we're definitely done with you. And so a lot of times they'll just do things. That was my big fear, you know, is that especially with COVID shots, if you go for medical treatment, are they going to sneak you a COVID shot just to increase their profits? That's yep. something to think about too. But we have just one more point here, and then I want to hear more about this person. And then I want to hear about Charlie Kirk too. I think he was there or in Zoom as well. But vaccines, yeah. You know that on Thursdays we have the world's greatest doctor panel here. Judy Mikovits, you know, Jim Thorpe, Ben Marble, who started My Free Doctor. Judy Mikovits goes back to AIDS and Dr. Fascist. And we have John Cullen, who actually created the COVID map that Johns Hopkins used, you know, to display all the countries and the COVID victims. He made that map. So listen to our show yesterday and listen to some of our Thursday shows and see if you can get them to Jackie Schlager, and let's get her on the show at a different time too. Maybe we'll get her on the doctor's panel. I think she'd find it fascinating. But these are the premier doctors in the country that talked about early treatments, that said that chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, you know, cure COVID. Yep. They said what I said, you know, back in, this is what I've been saying since March 2nd, that chloroquine kills COVID. There's no need for vaccines. One of my first bills on COVID, February 27th, I'm almost done. February 27th, I wrote a bill that Congress can only spend half their money on vaccines. The other half has to be spent on early treatments. Well, that's when I got censored. You know, then I came on March 2nd and said, chloroquine kills COVID. It's all a hoax. The vaccines are a hoax.
Yeah.
Not the virus. Virus is real, but it doesn't affect you that much, especially your age group, and then everything else. Yeah. Well, let's talk about her. Do you have any more on Jackie? She sounds really interesting, but I think she'd love our Thursday panel.
Yeah, I definitely sure she would.
So tell me about Charlie Kirk, because I want him on the show too, because he's got the college end of it.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. He only spoke for about 30 minutes. But he talked about college and how there's really, it's just a big scam. Like 40% of college students end up dropping out. So that's a really high number. And then 40% that get a degree end up getting a job that doesn't need a degree. So you just wasted, what, $50,000?
Well, it's an interesting question. Let me ask you a question on that, because I've had jobs where I used my college degree and I've had jobs where I didn't. This job uses everything I've done my entire life. So this uses my college internship in Washington, but that was back in 1980. You know, this my time in college, I started in the late 70s. You know, and so I got a couple of degrees: economics, minor political science, and a degree in environmental studies. I don't think I've actually said that on the air, but anyway, I got two bachelors. I was an overachiever. I took courses in constitutional law. I learned a ton of things in my Washington internship. There are some experiences that I had that were incredible. You know, federal law enforcement, flight instructor, book author, you know, really horrible jobs because of bad circumstance, bunch of things. And now here doing Action Radio, literally every job and tour guide. I was a tour guide for 8 years, you know, driving ducks and motorized cable cars in San Francisco. But do you know how much microphone experience I got then? You know, tons.
Yeah.
You know, so every job I've had and everything I studied in college, from plant ecology, you know, to organic chemistry, to economics, to politics, to law, I took a bunch of law courses, constitutional law, every one of those, although I didn't use my degree immediately after college, every one of those applies here. My flight instruction, that's a teaching certificate, basically, a flight instruction, that applies. So everything I've done, so it's not a good thing, I think, to say that because you take things in college, you know, if you don't use it immediately after, that's a waste. That, because you never know when in your life it's going to apply. And you can't see that yet because you haven't been. But you will, you know, 20, 30 years from now, you go, oh, gee, that was interesting. And these things fall into place. The really disturbing one is that 40% of the people drop out. How many of those had student loans? Do we know how percentage of those people had student loans?
I'm sure 100% of them.
So now they're paying for loans for a product that they didn't get or didn't use.
Yep.
Did that come up?
It did not come up. So that is a good point, yeah.
Hmm. Let's get Pianki back in here, and then we'll get back to our – we'll do 10 minutes of Constitution. Pianki, any comments so far?
Well, there's a lot of things to be to comment on. And Amber is starting off on the right foot, I think. Did you know that when Eric Holder was in the position he was on the Obama administration, that he wanted to have a race-based quotas in school discipline, saying that too many blacks are suspended? Now, I want Amber to think about that, just on the basis of what he's saying. But how in the heck would you implement that? I really don't understand some of these democratic ideas. And you need to share that with your peers, because this is something that they need to think about, because it's going to affect them in a negative way, as we are witnessing now when they become of age.
I agree. You know, it's what we have right now is not the greatest to work with, unfortunately. We have a lot to change.
Well, here's a problem, and I know this was true during the Obama administration, that white people could not make Civil Rights Act things. The Civil Rights Commission did not, they weren't taking cases of white guys especially who were complaining civil rights violations. So if you have a situation where you've got a white student who was victimized and a black student who was not punished for exactly the same offense, you've got discrimination. Well, discrimination, racial discrimination is prohibited in federal law. You know, Title 42, yeah. I think that's where it is. You know, by the Civil Rights Act, you can't discriminate on the basis of race. And yet that's a discrimination on race. Well, the relief from discrimination on race is the Civil Rights Commission and the EEOC. But if they're not taking claims from white people because they don't care, because that's not their agenda, you've got double discrimination. You're discriminated against not only because somebody else got better treatment than you, you're also being discriminated against because, you know, you can't go, me, the white guy here, can't go before the Civil Rights Commission and get the same relief that somebody of a different race would.
Yep.
So Holder was so wrong. So here's a question. Here's a law that I don't, Pianki, I don't know if we've talked about this. I brought it up yesterday. Title 18, Section 241, Conspiracy Against Rights, which says if any two or more people conspire to oppress the exercise or enjoyment of a constitutional right, those folks can be imprisoned up to 10 years and fined thousands and thousands of dollars. And so this is a case where Eric Holder should have been arrested for conspiracy.
Just look at the case in Georgia where you had the white, I can't think of the guy's name, that was involved in a scuffle over a gun that led to Ahmaud Arbery getting killed. The Garland's Department of Justice tried him on a hate crime and gave him life in prison.
Hmm.
Now, when you talk about a hate crime, that's just simple assault. When do you give a person life in prison for simple assault? So what you have going on is they're attacking white males utilizing the justice system in order to spur on emotional voter reaction out of blacks. That's exactly what I think is going on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Did you talk about racial issues and quotas and things like that in the course of Patriot Academy? Did they come up with, were they as blatant as we are about the discrimination? Like I'm saying, white guys could not go to the Civil Rights Commission during the Obama administration. I don't imagine that's changed now under the Brandon insurrection. I bet you it's probably the same situation, which has a chilling effect so that, folks aren't going to go, you know, because there's no relief possible anyway. So why bother?
Mm-hmm.
Did that come up, any kind of racial issues come up, CRT, things like that? Go ahead.
We didn't talk about anything racially. We did talk about transgender and stuff like that.
What'd they say about that?
But the transgender?
Mm-hmm.
It was basically debunking their it's my truth type thing, their my truth argument.
What is that argument? Lay that one out for me because I'm curious. I've barely heard that term, but what does that mean, it's my truth?
So they're saying,
I can guess, but yeah.
They're saying I have my truth and you have your truth. Basically, that truth is subjective. but it's not.
So if I say the sky is blue and you say no, it's green, then you're perfectly okay seeing the sky is green, even though objectively and scientifically we've all proven it's blue. Is that where this goes? I mean, that's an absurd example, but it illustrates the point. So these people actually believe that their truth is their truth. If they think they're a woman and they're really a dude and want to go swim in the women's swim team and they're actually a dude, in their minds, that's their truth, even though it's an objectively a lie. Is that the argument?
There was an example of a, I want to say like a 70-year-old man. He has a wife and 7 kids, and he decided, I'm actually a 6-year-old girl. He found parents to adopt him and take him in. He has an 8-year-old sister. Crazy what these people think their truth is.
So what did they say about it at the academy?
We were talking about how ridiculous it is. Like people will just assume, oh, look, all of a sudden I'm a girl and I'm actually a guy. That does not make sense. I recently watched Matt Walsh's What is a Woman? I don't know.
Matt Walsh. Yeah. Now, are you in contact with him? Because he'd be a fabulous guest also. I'm lining up. I got a lot of homework for you. I mean, I'm sorry. You know too many cool people. Did you talk to him at all?
I did not. He was on Zoom as well. So it was.
Okay. All right.
Kind of.
I've seen that video, you know, the I am a woman. All these women say that they can't define what a woman is. Amber, can you define what a woman is?
Yeah.
Now that you're an adult.
It's interesting because they go to Africa, to a tribe in Africa, and they can tell you exactly what a woman is. And they laugh at our culture today. They laugh at us. That's how ridiculous it is.
I saw the video. This clip of this guy says, well, we know what a woman is. We know what a man is. What's your problem? You idiots. It really was funny. But you don't have to go that far. You can ask any conservative or any thinking adult. You know, we know what men and women are. It's a chromosome thing. And the visual differences are obvious.
Yep.
You know, but just you are what you say you are. You are what you are. You know, you're not what you think you are. You are what you actually are. And now here's the question, though. Let's get into the emotional side of this. If you say something to somebody who has their truth, if you've got an 80-year-old dude who thinks he's a 6-year-old kid, and you say to him, look, you idiot, you're an 80-year-old dude. And they say, well, I'm offended. What's your response?
Does the truth hurt? Is the truth offend you?
That's a great
response. It's the truth.
Yeah. You know, I don't know how you put this, but, you know, your truth is wrong. You know, your truth isn't truth. You're an idiot. No. So, that's okay. If some dude wants to believe he's a 6-year-old kid, that's okay. As long as he doesn't actually physically act on it and join with other 6-year-olds. Because now you've got a huge problem. You're breaking the law. It's like somebody that identifies as a woman who's really a dude and starts going to women's restrooms. Okay, you can call yourself a woman all day. I don't care about that. But the minute you infringe on anybody else's rights, you know, like Mike Thomas, the swimmer. Of course, you know, my solution to that is to do a photo shoot with the women's swim team in bikinis. And he's going to stand out in a really disgusting way. but that's how you handle that. So ridicule. If you ever study mass psychosis, we should talk about this too. I don't know if that came up in the conference with COVID. But the cure for mass... Oh, there's my 90-second warning kind of loud. The cure for mass psychosis is truth, ridicule, and parallel structures. So you tell the idiot that's not your truth. This is the objective truth. And then you ridicule, you make fun of them. And a parallel structure, Action Radio is a parallel structure. Patriot Academy is a parallel structure. It's a legislature, you know, it's a private legislature, you know, modeling, you know, the corrupt legislature, but showing how it should be done, a better job. Our legislature is, and these are all the ways we combat mass psychosis. Obviously, we'll talk about Constitution next time because we've got to run out of time for this one. But did you get into mass psychosis and the psychology of COVID? And did they talk about COVID at all?
We talked a little bit about COVID, but it wasn't the main focus. I think some of the speakers maybe touched on it a little bit, but not like a speaker was dedicating their speech to COVID.
Okay, I guess my last question is the actual legislative part of it. Did the students come away with the vast knowledge? Did you enjoy debating in the halls of the Austin, you know, Texas Capitol? What was the feeling on that of actually doing, you know, being in a legislative place? Because I think that's an incredible place to hold that kind of thing.
Oh yeah, it was amazing. It was, you know, the Texas Capitol is just.
Your tax dollars at work. That's why it's gorgeous. Yeah. Yeah, they didn't pay for it.
We found out that the Texas Capitol is the tallest capitol in the nation, even exceeding the nation's capital. Texas really knows how to assert our dominance.
We're taller than you are. Do you know how much is taller? I was just curious.
I'm not sure. There's a statue on top of it, so I think that adds to the height.
Okay.
But I'm not sure how tall it is exactly. But
well, it had to be built later. It had to be built later than the Washington
right.
Capitol, otherwise, because that's a Texas thing. I'm sure the original Capitol was a little shorter. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the whole legislative process was really interesting to learn, and it was fun to get up and debate bills and propose amendments and all of that. So.
So which ones passed? Which were some of the most popular? I think you had 100 out of 1,000 filed and 100 passed or something, or what was the count?
There were 100 bills or 150 bills filed. 10 of
them
passed.
Okay. So do you remember what the 10 were that passed? I'm curious.
Yeah, let me pull them up. So one of them was abolishing the federal minimum wage. That one was passed unanimously. There was another one that was relating to the criminal procedures for students accused of misdemeanors or felonies. That one was basically saying that if a student commits a class, let me pull it up. Ooh.
That was the racial one that you don't get different treatment because of your race. Was that the one we talked about?
No, this one was saying because students are currently protected. Like if they threw a chair at a teacher, they would basically get a parking ticket. So they wouldn't actually receive the punishment equivalent to their crime. So this bill is basically saying if you commit a Class B or C misdemeanor, then you're going to the law enforcement and the law enforcement will deal with you.
So you're treated as an adult for certain crimes then? Is that how they worded it?
Right.
Okay.
Basically, instead of being protected by the school board, you're now accountable to the law enforcement.
Huh, that makes sense. That might prevent some school shootings ultimately, you know, if you catch the smaller crimes, you know, you can, and once people establish a record, they can be investigated. So, you know, people say we have to do something.
This bill is actually going to the Texas legislature in the upcoming legislative session.
Oh, it is. So are the legislators picking up on the bills that you guys are filing? I mean, this is Action Radio. This is the same thing that we do. This is great.
This one, the Texas legislators didn't know about. And so when we had one of our representatives there and he realized, oh, I'm also bringing this bill, he was behind it the whole way.
Yeah.
So we had Steve Toast there, who is a really great guy. He's my representative in the State House. He's the one that I've worked with a little bit.
No, bring him on the show. Bring him seriously.
Oh, I'm sure he would.
Yeah, we need you for a good couple of years. I've already booked you out for like lots of stuff to do. Yeah, bills, guests. Yeah, we're gonna keep you busy.
Yeah, he also wrote the Texas Heartbeat Bill for.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, so he's proposing this one in the upcoming legislative session, so it'll be fun.
Yeah.
One of our bills made it to the actual House floor.
See, that's perfect. That's the way it's supposed to work. You know, in other words, our mission statement here at Action Radio is that we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed. So we write the laws and we submit them to the legislature and say, this is how we consent to be governed. Now, they can still reject it. They can amend it. And then we can, you know, vote them out of office. So, but if we are the origin point of bills as opposed to the special interest, that completely changes politics forever. You know, why should Big Pharma write themselves, you know, vaccine product liability immunity? I mean, the American people would never vote for that. American people would never want that. You know, Joe's Donut Shop has product liability. Why shouldn't Big Pharma? So that's the difference. So we write the bills that we consent to be governed by and then submit them to the legislature. Okay, let's maybe one or two more, and then we should probably end this week. This has been fun. I'll see if Bianchi has a final comment, too. Did you – any more bills you wanted to go over of the 10?
Yeah, I'm pulling up the –
Okay, I got time. Oh, Pianki, do you have a final comment while Amber's looking?
Well, there will be two or three more hours of programming to get all the comments that we have.
Yeah, I know. We have to end sometime. Well, that's why we pick it up next week. Yeah. We'll do it again. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
There was another bill that was for the state of Oklahoma saying adoptive parents don't have to pay the mother's living expenses. So like if they're adopting a newborn baby, the adoptive parents don't have to pay the rent for the mother, the birth mother, the groceries, all of this stuff for the mother, which is currently required in the state of Oklahoma.
Well, that's interesting. So this is before the baby's born. So they're actually, they've actually arranged the adoption before the baby's born.
Right.
Well, that's, I didn't even know that happened. Yeah, and so how many women are using this, you know, as a business? I mean, I'm sure it's hopefully a small percentage, but how many women are you know, having babies because their medical expenses are paid? So you want to do that just to commit, just to stop the fraud. I mean, if you want to have a kid, that's fine. Right. If something goes wrong and you want to give your kid up for adoption, that's fine too. But you shouldn't be in the business of getting pregnant specifically to keep yourself in somebody else's income. Did that come up at all?
Right. Yeah, it did a little bit, basically saying that currently there's an incentive to give your child up for adoption. You know, you get your living costs paid for, your groceries, your rent, all of the stuff is paid for if you give your child up for adoption before.
Yeah, so that's not right. See, I agree with that. Yeah, you shouldn't have an incentive to have an adoption. If any incentive, it should be to have your own kid and find a way to keep your own kid.
Right.
So I would
think.
That
would be the purpose of
the bill. You know, these are real nuts and bolts bills. You know, I don't see National Donut Day. I don't see massive, you know, this is why you have conservatives. I don't see, you know, broad sweeping things. You know, there's no resolution that America is a racist country. You know, it's fascinating. Is there a liberal equivalent of Patriot Academy in Texas?
Sure. Not in Texas, no.
Well, because you know, it'd be interesting just for fun. This is purely optional. But if you find the liberal equivalent, find out the bills that they sponsored and that they passed. That would be hysterical. That would be fun.
Yeah.
Purely optional. Don't have to. Okay. Let me get your closing comment. Let's end the week and we'll pick it up again next week.
Yeah.
So,
I had
final
a lot
comments.
Of fun,
yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It was really interesting talking about Patriot Academy. I definitely recommend it to anyone ages 16 to 25, I think. It's a great learning experience. You don't have to be interested in politics. You don't have to want to major in politics, nothing like that. It's such a fun experience.
Sounds good. And when you get a website or a Facebook group or something like that, feel free. You can give any kind of contact information. But I wouldn't do personal information just because we have a pretty wide-reaching audience. You might get Azerbaijan. Mm-hmm. You know, who's the 18-year-old that's on your show? Yeah, we want to buy your reporter. No, sorry, ain't going to happen. I'm real protective of my folks on the show. So anyway, but so if you get something that you can release publicly, and I encourage you also to take a look at some of the groups that we have. We have the Action Radio Legal. Slow down, Craig. Action Radio Legal Project, our Special Investigations Project. We've got a new Economics Project. We have our some of the other groups, the Action Radio Group for news, and sort of like a general group and things like that. So there's a bunch of things. There's a bunch of different things that you'll find within Action Radio. We even have a student advocacy page, which something that group has totally gone. I made that, you know, by students for students, and then they didn't care. So it's there.
Yeah.
It hasn't been used, and we have a homeschool page too. So there's different things that you might find that you want to help advocate, or if you want to moderate a group, just let me know. I'll send you an invite. And this is endless variety of stuff going on here. But thank you very much. Thanks for the report. Thanks for doing what you're doing. And I'm glad we're going to be in the same area, because then we can chat and get you to meet all the other reporters. Yeah. And this is going to be very, very cool. All right. Let's do it next week.
Yep. I'll be here.
Thanks very much. Greg Penglis for Action Radio. Goodbye now. Ed, I should probably give people a chance to say goodbye. I'm so into my radio stuff. Sorry. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Our legislative website is writeyourlaws.com. That's WRITEYOURLAWS. If you want to be a sponsor of the show, you can contact me, Greg, at writeyourlaws.com. That's our email. If you want to be a contributor, we've got our PayPal at where can I find it here? Yeah, I can't believe I've lost my PayPal. Where is it? It moved. It did move. What if it's still on my page? Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. PayPal.com/PayPalMe/Action Radio. And we have affiliate relationships with MyPillow, with Grace Care, and with Strikeforce Energy Drinks. And you go to those websites. And I forgot to play the commercials. We got so busy. But WYL is our discount code. So for MyPillow, Grace Care, and Strikeforce, WYL is our discount code. I'll be back Monday morning, 7 a.m. Central Time. And we'll do it then.